Interesting subject. Who's sane and who isn't? Hard to tell sometimes. Do you know anything about paranoia?
It's a form of hallucination, isn't it?
Delusions of persecution. Starts with an inability to withstand stresses. Normal person experiences misfortune, throws it off sooner or later. But if a person is psychotic to begin with, he may start to imagine things. He might even begin to imagine there's a conspiracy against him. That's when he gets dangerous.
Do you have a specific case in mind, Doctor, a person that you're treating?
No, it's out of my field. I'm a general practitioner, not a psychiatrist.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 30th of April 2021. Bank holiday weekend, isn't it? Not that that means a lot nowadays with so many people furloughed, etc. But we're streaming live anyway from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and RadioQUK.com in Camberley. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information, sadly the norm in the UK today, due to the collusion of the jellyfish media managers. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast over the weekend, just let me know and we'll credit you here. I'm the COVID secure Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news on our pre-election politician-free politics show is Bristol's Blue Hackney Cabs representative Saf Hussain, and also, as ever, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, the secret war in Mali going on that NATO is waging. Of course, the press aren't talking about that, are they? And Biden actually getting to the point where we may be rolling back the Iran sanctions. That would be marvellous. But will the Israel lobby allow that to happen? We take a really good look this week at the lobbies. How do these lobbies really operate? And one person in the world that seems to be the best at pulling them apart, Bristol University, could be about to sack him. That's Professor David Miller, Professor of Sociology. He'll be talking about how these lobbies work, how our politicians get bribed effectively during the year in between when we vote. And we really have to try and vote for someone that's unbribable, don't we? Which isn't very easy. Also on the same subject, the police, the Bent Coppers series finished on Wednesday evening this week. Wonderful 3 weeks of classic television, amazing stuff to watch, and so we'll be having a clip from that later too. My book, The Traitors of Arnhem, The Origins of the Bilderberg Group, is finally out in paperback, so we will be having a little look at that. I'll maybe throw a copy at Martin and he can tear it apart, do what he wants with it, and poo-poo it, but he might even say, actually, that's quite interesting and quite useful and quite good. You never know. And our conspiracy classics number four, one of the most interesting people on the planet, Anton Chaitkin, whose father was Jacob Chaitkin. He was the Jewish attorney and strategist to, back in World War II, the American Jewish Nazi boycott of Nazi Germany. So Anton Chaitkin, a fascinating guy, his son. Well, I mean, you know, I think what I think about Anton is that he's basically the purveyor of the entire rabbinic tradition from Europe that was wiped out by Hitler, or at least Hitler tried to wipe it out. But many of those people came to Jacob, and they come to Anton too, to tell us what's really going on. He looks at the real history of the British Empire. I think fascinating stuff. Conspiracy classics number four. But before all that, we'll be looking at some national and local stories. The city slackers, the worst of the most slippery and shamelessly ambitious councillors and politicians over the last 5 years, apart, obviously, from the mayor, Marvin Rees. We'll look at some of those. Also, some of the alleged criminals at Lloyds Bank, maybe not even alleged anymore because the Law Lords actually ruled against Avon and Somerset Police. Maybe that's why both the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Chief Constable are taking a walk, hey? Maybe they should take a walk to a cell rather than into a nice, comfy retirement. And we're having the Police and Crime Commissioner elections. We'll be talking a bit about that. The Metro Mayor, who is the Metro Mayor? What do they do other than introduce scooters? And I found out it was the Metro Mayor who's one of the main people behind that. No wonder he wants to stay in the shadows. And we'll be talking a little bit about Dan Norris, who's the Labour candidate. And Police and Crime Commissioners, well, one of them or two of them might really make a difference and put some Bent Coppers, which is the name of that series we were watching over the week, behind bars. Who knows? But anyway, joining me first is Saf Hussain, who represents, well, actually diminishing numbers of blue cab drivers here in Bristol, Saf, don't you?
Yeah, hi, good day. Nice to meet you guys.
Let's just start with the numbers. We've gone down, haven't we, since, say, 2012, 812 blue cabs in Bristol?
That's right. In 2012, we used to have 812 blue cabs licensed in Bristol. And the latest figures show that there's now only 354 left. We've got about 100 drivers leaving every year, and there's probably even less than 354 right now, because that's just what's on the paperwork. And
so, I mean, just thinking about the population around here and in South Gloucestershire, you've got really we've gone from more than 1,000 to less than 1,000 per one cab, population per cab. I mean, because they are it's very important. So you've gone down, well, that's less than half, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we cover all the work in Bristol. We've got Bristol Private Hire and other companies as well. But we like to put ourselves out as picking up wheelchair customers, looking after people that need, vehicles that fit their needs, where they can push in a wheelchair. And, I think... the council really should really be helping us in some ways to keep that tradition going, rather than potentially having in the future not enough or maybe.
Well, so do you have to pay for your licences from the council?
Yeah, so all taxis in most counties, they work as they have to pay for a licence every year, which isn't too expensive. It's about a couple of hundred a year for the plate licence and about 50 quid for the driver licence. But where the blue cabs differ is we are required to be wheelchair accessible, and these cars are a good 30% more expensive, and we've got to paint them blue as well.
And yes, I remember that was under George Ferguson, and that was obviously even for people who just bought brand new cabs, maybe a black one or a green one or something, suddenly they had to splash out again and get the thing painted blue.
Yeah.
Bristol's traditionally blue, isn't it? Maybe that's blue for Tory, but maybe it's blue for blue glass, and we'll be hearing a bit more about the Bristol blue glass a little bit later. But what's the idea, do you think, behind having every cab blue?
Well, it was strange, because for many years we were multicolored cars, whatever, blue, silver, red, and just around, I think it was around 2012, about the same time, where they started saying, look, you have to...
Well, it was just after Mayor Ferguson turned up. I think he decided that he wanted all the cabs blue, which is a bit bizarre. I wonder if it was anything to do with him.
So it's a good thing now, because at the moment, it's the only way to differentiate between a proper taxi and any other car. Because if we were different colours now, you wouldn't recognise us. So I'm starting to like Bristol Blue, actually. It's funny. I didn't like it first, but
do you drink Harvey's Bristol Cream?
I don't go out much.
Because that's also blue glass. Well, you might be Muslim and you don't drink anyway. But Martin Summers, the idea that it doesn't matter over the less than halving of the numbers of cabs in Bristol, I find it rather appalling, really, when we've got a nasty bus service, which is extremely expensive and pretty unreliable, as we quite often see. Buses just simply not turning up. All sorts of complicated apps that you've got to have on your phone. And if your power goes down just as you're getting on the bus, you're not allowed to get on, or you can't. But it's important. Public transport is very important, isn't it?
It is, and it's not just. It shouldn't just be a free for all.
People often don't think of cabs.
It should be an integrated system.
Well, yeah, people often don't think of cabs as public transport, but they are, aren't they?
Well, of course they are, and in a sense, it's all based on regulations, either tighter or looser regulations. And of course, you don't want people being picked up in the middle of the night by people who they don't know who they are, and you could have all sorts of things going on. You could get rapes. Robberies, and you've got to have some control over who gets the right to work in this field.
Uber is slowly moving in, isn't it? Now, I mean, in the old days, I mean, it seems like that, but it's even just a couple of years ago, there's this big difference between Hackney cabs like yours and private hire, where you can phone up and get someone to come around and give you a specific lift. But Uber are kind of hovering in between those two.
I think they're more than hovering. They're really they're taking over, like
swooping.
Yeah, it almost looks like 9 out of 10 jobs. They're doing them, and then they're picking them up. But if you ask me, I think it's good to have a healthy competition. You know, if Uber works correctly, I don't have a problem with that. But the thing is, if our council or, I don't know, whoever, if they want to get rid of blue cabs, then there's no healthy competition anymore. And if you have a company like Uber solely take over the whole trade without any competition, we've heard of their surge charges in the night, like 3 times whatever your fare is. And these kind of practices are unheard of in Bristol before Uber arrived. I mean, I would never think of charging somebody 3 times more just because it's busy. So by having us there, the customers have an option. And if you, around 9 o'clock in the night when Uber does their surge, people stop using Uber and they start using blue cabs because they know that our rates are fixed on the meter and they're guaranteed the same price and stuff. So it would be nice to just keep us there. Otherwise,
yeah, I mean, they've had a bit of a battle in London, Uber, haven't they? They were on the back foot for a while, but Sadiq Khan's now, and the courts have now said, yeah, okay, go for it in London. And I suppose a similar thing happening here.
Yeah. Yeah, I really think they should... They should clamp down on that surcharge, you know. They should have some sort of a fixed rate, really.
You know what? It seems to me that like the whole world is going for a free-for-all. If you can get away with it,
yeah,
you can do it. And regulation is out the window, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, of course, ultimately, that's not to the benefit of the consumer or the wider society.
Well, that's right. And Uber, by the way, have admitted that 5 of its drivers are accused of rape and up to 170 of sexual assault. This is what happens when you don't get proper regulation and anyone can, with a driving licence, can suddenly become a cab driver. Ride-sharing service admits it had 5 reports of rape in 3 years, 170 sexual assault claims over the same period, and leaked documents, though, reveal that 5,800 results under the search for rape on the Uber database. Firm says drivers have robust background checks and they're investing in new technology to improve passenger safety. Well, I don't know how new technology can improve passenger safety if the regulations aren't there to make double checks about people who are actually driving Uber cabs.
Yeah, you're right. And I visit a lot of forums where the authorities, they talk about these things. And they're talking about making it more strict because there's a lot of sexual offences in the taxi trade. And these authorities seem to think that it's anything to do with hackneys around the country or blue. We're blue because we're in Bristol. But it's like they don't understand. Hang on. Hackneys and Uber are different. We have a different crime level to them. Our drivers are mostly over the age of 45 years old in Bristol. A lot of them have been driving for 10 to 12 years. And we have a very, very low crime rate in blue cab taxis. It's the new drivers that, you know, maybe 25, and they've just come into the taxi trade and they're not very experienced, and I don't know from what background they come from, and they're the ones that are doing these crimes, and it's getting, people are looking at us if it's anything to do with us when it's not. So
well, apparently one of the reasons Uber did so well so early that was that our friend David Cameron, former Prime Minister, Conservative, who's also been in the news the last few weeks for all sorts of lobbying that he shouldn't have been doing. He was actually literally pushing Uber, is that right?
Yeah, he was definitely. I read an article in the Daily Mail that he was trying to slow down any restrictions on Uber because people wanted to put restrictions on how they operate because it was too easy for them. And I don't know, I heard he was in talks with Boris Johnson, who was the mayor of London at the time. So I don't know if that made it easier.
Well, this is lobbying, isn't it? So Uber gets in touch with Dave, shoves him a bit of money, tells Boris, phones him up, says, Boris, the word's come down. Uber is our friends. Mm-hmm. By the way, here's a brown envelope with £1,000 in it. And off they go. I mean, this is really the way it seems things work nowadays. Yeah. No, so no wonder there's a bit of a fuss about, I mean, I be honest with you, all this stuff that's been going on the last week or so about the Prime Minister's flat in Downing Street, I don't care about that. What I care about is proper housing for millions of people across the country. And I do care about this lobbying stuff, though, because the idea that you can just simply buy favours, Martin, is outrageous, isn't it, really? I mean, this is the sort of thing we expect in a banana republic. But it's now happening here, as a matter of course.
I can add to that is the... early days when Uber started in the UK, there was a place in London where they could just walk in and get a badge without doing any knowledge test. So it was like, in you go, out you come out with your badge. And they was using that London badge to work everywhere in Bristol, in the whole of UK. And these were drivers that had, they didn't even know where they were going. And they had a satellite navigation.
Oh, if they've got sat-nav, they don't need to, do they?
Yeah, but then it's nice to have somebody with the knowledge, who's done the knowledge test and the hard work to pick you up. You don't want somebody who's just following a sat-nav.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, of course, that the conditions of the people who work for Uber are inferior to the conditions of people working for other organisations.
Yeah.
So you're basically driving down people's wages and conditions and quality of life. And of course, what Deliveroo is, all of these platforms that have emerged, they're not treating their workers as they're treating them as self-employed when in actual fact they're not.
Does it really make any difference if they're in the gig economy or if they're properly employed by someone?
Well, if they're in the gig economy, you're ultimately going to get a situation where people can't make a living doing the job. And therefore, you're undermining the stability of the situation for everybody.
Well, it sounds to me like the blue cab drivers are having difficulty making a living.
Yeah, we are, because we have all the legislation put on us. We've got to be blue, we've got to have a wheelchair, we've got to do the knowledge test. We need now we're going to have to buy electric vehicles soon. So all our business related stuff is really expensive, and we've done it the hard way. Whereas an Uber, everything about their business model for the driver is cheap, is cheerful, less regulations. They can go, the reason they go to South Gloucestershire is they can have a 5-year-old car. We can only have a 3.5-year-old car in Bristol. So they've got cheaper cars, easier test.
Okay, so there's a different regime in Bristol and South Gloucestershire.
Yes, yeah. So I don't know if you know, but at the moment, it looks like 9 out of 10 jobs being picked up in Bristol are an Uber South Gloucestershire.
Oh, right.
And we've only got the Bristol Private Hire and the Bristol Hackney. We've only got about 10-15% of the share, I would say, roughly around there. So the reason these Uber, they're licensing South Gloucestershire, the cars are cheaper, they can be 5 years old, the test is easier, and the whole... it's a lot easier to do it in South Gloucestershire. Before, it was London, as I said. So now they've chosen South Gloucestershire. And so it's really easy for the driver. And that's why you will see these brown plates on the back of the car.
Right.
So these are not Bristol. Bristol is either a white plate for a Hackney or a yellow plate for a private hire. These are official Bristol taxis. But now it's entirely brown plates. So it'd be City of South Gloucestershire. And that's not really fair, because they don't have a customer and they drive into Bristol. So they wait here for, I don't know, however long, and then they get a job in Bristol. And they do that all night long, all week long. Well, if they're licensed in South Gloucestershire, why don't they work in South Gloucestershire?
Well, it doesn't sound to me like there's anybody keeping a check on the licensing around here at all. I mean, I suppose you could go and get a license in somewhere... I don't know, like Glasgow, and come and work down here. If you
anywhere.
Wanted to, you can look around, shop around the country to where the dodgiest council with the cheapest license and the cheapest conditions are. This is deregulation gone mad, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Don't you ever think yourself sometimes about, well, there's no point in doing the blue cabs, I might as well become an Uber driver?
Initially, when the Deregulation Act kicked in, the argument was, the boundaries... The taxi might just want to come slightly into the boundary and slightly back out and back into his boundary, and it will make it more efficient. Well, what's happened now is the out-of-boundary cabs have completely took over Bristol.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there is a law here, and that is just the law of money. So if you're going to make more money, you can do it. And the government is on the back foot. They apparently haven't got hardly any money, local government. And anyway, they can't be bothered. So that's the rule, is that the money talks and nothing else matters. Yeah. This is fascinating. Anyway, look, so I know you went and had a meeting this week with the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, about a lot of this. I wonder, did you manage to squeeze any promises out of him for the next term? He's going to be in for another 4 years if he manages to squeak back in.
Yeah, so this is the other thing what we haven't talked about. We had a protest, yes.
Yeah.
And
this is about a month ago, isn't it? Yeah. Around the Bear Pit. So a whole load of... this is at the bottom of Gloucester Road here in Bristol. And a whole load of cabs just started circling around the Bear Pit and then all stopped. So that brought traffic in the city to a halt. Yeah. Now, how long did you do that for?
It was probably about an hour. And it was from 8 to 10, but mostly about an hour of it was the blockage. Really sad that we had to do it. I don't like doing stuff like that. But I had to send a message, and my drivers wanted to send a message to the council. Look, what you're doing isn't right. What was happening is we had many ranks in the centre of Bristol, and people listening from Bristol, they probably know that there used to be about three ranks in the centre, and now...
Well, around the Hippodrome area. Yeah, right, around there. Yeah.
You can't find a rank anymore. Nobody knows where a rank is. Because in the last few years, the council have reduced the number of ranks and put them in the furthest corners where you'd never find them. And one of our major ranks or meeting points for customers was the Hippodrome.
That's right, yeah. It's the best known rank in the centre of the city.
Everyone knows that who's been going out and drinking. And so back in 2012, they started saying, oh, we're going to move it, we're going to not let you work there. Then they said, look, we've removed the rank. And for 8 years, they let us work there up until last October. And all of a sudden, they put a camera and automatically it started sending us lots of fines. And we had about 75 fines in 1 month. Like, that's a lot of money, like £50 each, yeah? And
so they're fining you for stopping to pick people up.
Yeah.
Now, the thing with the Hippodrome, just for people that don't know the city, is there's a big area around the waterfront which is pedestrianised. So obviously on a Saturday night in normal times, it's absolutely thriving and thronging with thousands of people. And so when you're coming back onto the transport system, the road network from there, you come down past the watershed, just past the end of the docks there. And the first thing you pretty much get when you cross the road is the Hippodrome. So this is one of the most important places to be if you're trying to pick up people who are trying to go home safely after a night's drinking, isn't it?
That's right. And what we've told the council is they've guised it as a safety issue. And we've said, look, we can work with you and correct any safety issues and work as you say. And we have largely improved the safety there. How we operate.
What's the safety? Why is it a safety issue?
Well, they're saying that if a Hackney blue car overranks, somebody coming around the corner might not see them. We're like, all right, well, it's been a year that we've told our drivers, don't park on that corner.
Right, so this, when you're saying overranks, that means when the rank's full and another driver wants to queue on the end of it. Yeah,
that's been a bit naughty. But we've spoken to our drivers and said, look, don't do this kind of stuff. And it's been over a year where our drivers are really good. Even the police officers saying that these blue cabs are really well behaved.
So there isn't a safety issue.
So there's the safety issue has been corrected, and we want to work with the council and improve anything around there. So anyway, now we're off. We're not at the Hippodrome anymore since they put the fines on. And what's happened is all those out-of-town taxis are starting to work on the Hippodrome.
So how come they're not being fined?
That's what I mean. Have they got
a special agreement with the CCTV people at the council?
Yeah, if you go out on a Saturday night now at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, you'll see those blue brown plates, private hire cars, parked 10 times worse than we ever parked, yeah? And they're not getting fined. And the council said, hang on, we said, look, why are they there? And they said, council said, look, if they've got a pickup, they're allowed 3 minutes to pick up there. And we're like, well, if there's hundreds of them, that's hundreds of cars, and they're doing worse than us. Why don't you find them?
Well, it's not really an appropriate place, you know, for a car, if it's not appropriate for you, yeah. it's not appropriate for them.
Yeah.
So anyway, so obviously there's some favouritism going on here. Anyway,
I think so,
you were
yeah.
putting that across, I imagine, to the mayor earlier this week.
So I put that across to the mayor. Mayor's really understanding of the situation, and I don't think he's 100% sure of what the wider problem was, but he's agreed to have a larger meeting with larger stakeholders, whoever, like the bus company and the police.
Well, can't he just say, no, I'll sort it out, I'll do it? Well, he wants to have another meeting.
Yeah, he wants to have a larger meeting. Because
after the election, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's after election now. And what we're afraid, because we don't think the safety issue is as bad as what they've blown it out to be. But if they blow it out and say, look, the safety issue is really, really bad, and that works against us, and then if that's the case, we don't get the Hippodrome, and then it's going to be a downward spiral for the blue cabs, and people would leave the company. And in the end, that you know, we might not have enough blue cabs just to service the wheelchairs, really.
This is another issue, isn't it? If the blue cabs go, where are disabled people supposed to get a cab from?
And that's right. And a lot of people don't realise when they ring up a private hire company asking for a wheelchair accessible car if they're disabled, it's us blue cabs that come and do that work because we get the work allocated to us. So that would be a twofold problem. They might not be able to get one on the phones, and they won't be able to get one off the street. I'm saying like in about 2-3 years' time. That's if we lose the Hippodrome. And the Hippodrome's important because that is most of our night work. So,
I wonder if similar things are going on here in Bristol, Martin, that are going on in London with Cameron and Uber. I mean, this is just in last Sunday's Mail on Sunday, Cameron being... found out for pushing for Uber in London, something similar going on here. I mean, this is the way these businesses work nowadays, isn't it? If they can get access to politicians privately, they will say, well, do what you can, we want in.
That's right, and it's not even clear that the business model of these internet-based firms is actually viable in the long run. Deliveroo, you know, because they deliver, you know, meals, they basically went public, you know, they had a public share issue in the City of London and it crashed completely. And it may well be going forward that all of these, just as what happened with the dot-com crash in 2000, is that they'll all go bust. And you could end up with a situation where you've got rid of the blue cabs,
mm-hmm.
Uber goes bust, yeah. And then you've got nothing at all.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What you really need is an integrated transport system with the buses
yeah.
linked to the taxis, yeah. linked to the railway, and then you want the minimum amount of cars on the street.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that happened with bus deregulation is you got loads and loads too many buses, and then of course you ended up with monopolies controlling, as First Bus does, you know, basically gouging the customers in Bristol, one of the you know highest levels of fares in the country.
So this Cameron lobbying scandal from last Sunday, thanks for pointing it out, Saf. He said that Transport for London was considering 25 measures, including making Uber and other private car hire firms wait at least 5 minutes between taking a booking and picking up a customer. It was hoped that this would curb the proliferation of these Uber cabs, but the mayor and his aides began receiving angry messages from Downing Street, forthright texts from Mr. Cameron and George Osborne. At the time, Mr. Cameron had close personal relationships with Rachel Whetstone, who's Uber's then senior vice president of policy and communications. How about that?
Yeah.
So you've got personal relationships really deciding these things. I mean, do you stand with that sort of culture? Do you stand a chance?
No. No, if it's
I know you're not the sort of people who would try and use personal influence.
We haven't got the power to do that. We're small.
Yeah. So do you think we'll be seeing maybe more protests? Because this is the sort of thing that, you know, I think even anyone who's sitting in a traffic jam gets frustrated. But when often what happens is once you find out what it's about, you know, oh, OK, this is people who are going to be made homeless or something. You know, you find, well, OK, fair enough. I'll sit here for 5-10 minutes and whatever, or turn around and go back a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I think if the mayor and the police are fair with us, and then we can get our rank back and we'd stand a chance. If they go against us and fall into the traps or whatever, whoever's pushing, I don't know, then, and if the Hackney does collapse, and if after all our protests nobody listens, we'll have to go. You know, we won't be there, and it will just play out in the next few years. People will realise what it was all about and how it's damaged the local workforce.
No, I think the thing is, we voted in a Labour mayor, Martin, 5 years ago. Labour is supposed to be looking after public transport. It's supposed to be the party. In fact, in London, in the 1980s, it very nearly made public transport free, if you can believe that, under Ken Livingstone. So what's going on here? Well, people have voted for a city that is run in at least a socialist manner, with certainly with tough regulation of these essential services. Really, this is the infrastructure of the city, but it's just been allowed to be bought up by the highest bidder.
Well, that's true, and of course the local councils have been denuded of powers that they used to have, so, and they've also been cut, their budgets have been cut.
This is nothing to do with that, really, is it? They have the power to give the blue cabs whichever ranks they
want.
They
certainly ought to have a concern for the long-run viability of the entire public transport system, rather than just going with the latest fads and fashions. And what you want is a stable setup where people have you don't want more cars on the street, for example, than you need. You don't want hundreds of cars. What for? It's causing congestion, ultimately that one of the goals they've got is to reduce traffic pollution. And if you're going to do you've got to have an overall plan.
Well, you know what? And if you're going to do that, you've also got to stop the pollution by the incinerators at Avonmouth. Listen, this is westerly wind here. We've just opened two new incinerators, one of them burning plastic at Avonmouth, and they're saying, oh, we mustn't have any, you know, we've got to get rid of the cars in the... I mean, this is a major change since the beginning of the pandemic, Saf, has been the road system in the city. We've had some Baldwin Street closed.
Yeah.
We've also had Bristol Bridge closed, which is... Actually, that's why Bristol's here, Bristol Bridge.
Yeah.
The first thing that ever was in Bristol is now closed by this mayor. Now, that's obviously made things a bit difficult for you guys.
So it's open, Baldwin Street is open to us. Most of all the places that the buses can go is open to taxis. So
is it made easier?
For us, it's easy, obviously, because we're the only ones with the access.
Oh, so you are allowed. You're not getting fined for going down Baldwin Street?
No, we don't get... Good. No. We're allowed
to
hear
it. Well, that's the obvious thing to do, is if you're going to pedestrianise and reduce traffic, then you've got to allow taxis and buses to pick people up.
But we're also now in a situation where the pandemic's starting to go away and things are starting to open up. The roads have all been narrowed quite a lot. For example, right... Great stretches of Park Row, you're not allowed
Park Row,
to stop.
Yeah. Be all right.
You know, can't stop anywhere. There's these bollards in the way. In fact, I saw the other day some car that had driven all the way down behind the bollards to park because they needed to go into a shop to pick something up, and they weren't allowed to park anywhere down there. So that also surely is going to affect the traffic flows in the city when things start opening up.
The thinning down of the lanes, because they've made two lanes into one on Park Row and quite a few places in the centre. And even before the coronavirus, when they just started doing that, it was a hell of a lot of congestion. And now they've done a few more. I hate to think next month when they open up the restrictions how bad the congestion's going to be. And we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, never mind, because all those cars that used to be at least moving are going to be sitting there going nowhere, churning out fumes.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to do anything for... I think, actually, what they're trying to do, it seems to me, is to create a hostile environment, you know, for... drivers. So drivers think, well, I'm going to park at a park and ride, or I'm going to get a train, or that sort of, that's the idea, it seems to me. But then there's also this diesel charge. And what I was quite shocked to see was that the cab drivers are going to have to pay it too.
Yeah. So I want to clear a few things up for that. The diesel charge is it's only 20% of our fleet. So it has levels
of... So you're saying most of your cars are petrol and
most
electric?
No, they're all diesel, but you have a Euro 6 diesel and you have a Euro 5 diesel. Euro 6 diesels are newer, and most of our fleet, 80%, are Euro 6. So we won't get charged. But there's a few percent which are Euro 5, about, you know, one in five of us. and they'll get charged.
Well, this is one of the things I find so annoying. Not that just that I've got a Euro 5 car, but anyone that's got a posh, new, expensive Range Rover diesel or whatever, the most expensive, like 60 grand car, they don't pay a thing.
They won't pay the charge, even if they've got a V8 engine, because they've got that catalytic converter. Doesn't matter how much carbon dioxide they're making, but that thing cleans up. It doesn't clean up the carbon dioxide, but it's a nitrous oxide. So even it may well be twice as polluting, but because it's got the special catalytic converter, it's okay because it's a Euro 6.
Oh, right. Okay. So quite a lot of your cab drivers won't be paying. What do you make of the diesel charge thing? Because a lot of delivery drivers have said they don't like it at all.
What we say is those 20% of drivers, they should have an exemption because they went out their way and bought a wheelchair car to service disabled people. Yeah. And disabled people have exemptions. So anything to do with them should not be subject to a charge.
I just find it shocking and incredible that any council leader, mayor, whatever, would be audacious enough to say, I'm going to charge my own cabs for using the streets of my city.
So this request did go to the mayor, and it, at the moment it's in the system. Yeah. So he hasn't made a decision yet because our fellow...
It's in the mayor's in-tray, which, by the way, has got about 10 tonnes of paper sitting in it, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I think that's just about it, but I'd just like to get your thoughts on just generally the whole political situation. You've got anything to say about the election? You know, what you think? Do you think it's worth voting? If so, who should we vote for? Because we've got three different elections going on. Well, you could say four, couldn't you? The city council's got two elections. It's got the election for mayor, and it's also got all the individual councillors from the parties around the city. We've also got the Metro Mayor, which is a mysterious figure that is... big splash over the last 5 years has been scooters, apparently, and he tries to make the buses and the trains work, but they still don't. And then you've got the Police and Crime Commissioner, who is supposed to oversee the police force, because as we know, the police forces sometimes go astray, and sometimes they're taking two salaries, one from the criminals and one from the public. So any thoughts about the elections coming up, sir?
Well, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I'm a very simple person, and I've never been very political.
Do you vote? Would you vote? You think it's important too?
I normally vote for whichever leaflet ever came through, or whoever's put the banner next to my house. I think, oh, that's nice, and I'll vote for them.
And but if the leaflet makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm probably the worst person for advice on the political.
Presumably, though, you'd want people to ask whoever's standing about the issues that you've raised.
Now, this is the first time I've ever looked into politics, and I thought, well, if somebody's not favourable to you, and then it's hard to vote for them, but...
One thing's for sure, the mayor system, the system that was brought in 2012 with George Ferguson on a very, very low turnout vote, and in fact, I think there were something like 10 cities around the country that decided, and Bristol was the only one to decide, yes, we do want a mayor, and that's largely because George Ferguson was being dangled in front of everyone, saying, we could have George running the city.
The cab trade, we voted for George Ferguson, and we voted for Marvin as well when he came in. And I still have hope in Marvin Rees. You know, I hope he helps us. He seems like from what I've talked to him, all right guy. So, but I'm just...
Well, the point being here is that we're faced with the choice now of potentially getting rid of the mayor system and going back to the system where the individual councillors will have much more say. Because right at the moment, it doesn't really matter what they say. They can vote this way, that way, left, right, up, down. Yeah. And the mayor just goes, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to do what I want. And so you do wonder what they're all doing there. They're getting paid 70 different councillors for the whole city.
Yeah.
And often, for example, they've been very challenging on some big, big planning and land decisions like Temple Island. What's going to happen with that? That was all supposed to be an arena. And then all of a sudden it changed and it's got taken over by the university, and it's going to be the big second campus for Bristol University. The decision wasn't made by the council, that was made by the mayor. And there's a lot of people who were saying, well, actually we want something which is going to be a public facility there, not something which is just the university's property. Obviously it's very valuable property, it was public land, and now it's been pretty much, well, it's been sold to this company called Legal & General. The deal was done basically on the back of an envelope. So there was no proper tendering out of the land. What you're supposed to do is you advertise it in these various magazines, the Times and things like that, and say, well, we've got a bit of land here. Would anyone like to say how much they'll pay for it and what they'll do with it? That simply didn't happen. It was just handed over to Legal & General. And we've also got these massive tower blocks being built in the city centre. There's one called, I think, Castle Park Gate or something. Castle Park Tower? Castle Park, anyway. Gigantic tower looming over the park. Yeah, so, you know, you're sitting there in the park and suddenly the sun moves around a little bit and, oh, it's all dark because there's a great big tower block just been built on what was the old ambulance service spot. So there's been some big changes with planning particularly, and these speculators and developers have had a field day, I'll say. I mean, we've seen, for example, the start of this thing called the Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks, because there's so many high-rise buildings going up. Now, Marvin the Mayor has been saying that it's great, we've got cranes on the horizon. But a lot of people are also saying, well, it's all very well building, but who is that building for? Is it just commercial development? Anyway, so, Martin, what do you make of this whole business of planning and development, because it does seem like the developers over the last 5 years have had a very easy ride?
Well, the whole point of the mayoral system as designed by the Tory Liberal coalition was they're going to reduce the funding to local authorities, they're going to get the business rate, and then of course they're pushed into doing deals with developers in order to get resources to get re-elected. So they're basically made out, you know, they become like CEOs of a business rather than answerable to the public. But I think there's various people standing at, as you know, there's 70 councillors to be elected, there's the mayor and so on. And I think from SAF's point of view, whoever's elected needs to take into account the issues that he's been raising.
Well, Sherlock Holmes, let's hope he doesn't have to look at the case of the disappearing taxi cab, because that really would be, I mean, a terrible blow, not only to disabled people across the city, but it would be a betrayal of everything that the city holds dear. You know, decent public transport, something that everybody at some point will need, and then you'll find, oh, we've got an Uber cab, and that's all you got, mate. Anyway, so I thought I'd try and get a bit of an insight into the character of our present mayor, Marvin Rees. He is somebody who I interviewed on our BCFM show just before the local elections back in 2016. And he very reluctantly came on the programme only when he found out that all the other mayor candidates were going to be sitting around the table except him on the same day of the show. He phoned me up and said, all right, I'll be there. And so he was extremely reluctant, even though, of course, he spent several years at the BBC. You would have thought he would be quite happy sitting around a radio studio and a radio table chatting about these things. But he didn't seem to want to do that. Also, there was an accusation, really, I think it was 2016, 2017, that was out in the Bristol Post, saying that Marvin Rees was passed over for promotion at the BBC because he was black. Now, certainly having spoken to people at the BBC, this is simply not the case. He was given all sorts of extra opportunities because actually the BBC is a particularly conscientious employer when it comes to equalities. And so it just was that story simply wasn't true. The other thing I found rather frustrating was that as a Labour Party member, he wasn't interested in joining the union. So he was approached several times by National Union of Journalists reps up at the BBC to join the National Union of Journalists, but he decided that he wasn't interested and refused to. So that's the sort of Labour mayor we're dealing with. But it was fascinating, I thought, to talk to James Adlington, who runs a business, Bristol Bluegrass, Blue Glass, here in Bristol, about an encounter he had with Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees up at Filton at the Bristol, I think, is it called the Aerospace Museum, where Concorde is? It's called Aerospace Bristol, isn't it? And this was actually, interestingly, Saf, this was the time when the business that's behind the scooters was just trying to sell them to the mayor. And apparently the mayor and the scooter guy went off at the end of the, hand in hand across the sunset at the end of the this business meeting. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to James Adlington describing the encounter with Marvin Rees that took place at this. To be fair to James, as he explains here. He's a very independent-minded businessman, and this was not his sort of normal event. He wouldn't normally go along to these business meetings with the university and people like that, because they're not the sort of people he gets on particularly well with. They're very money-minded and hard-headed, and he's a bit of a punk, actually. He was a punk singer in his younger days. And so here's James describing his encounter with Marvin Rees up at the Aerospace Museum a few years ago, just as they were getting ready to introduce those wonderful scooters.
I went up there and there were, you know, it was all chaos as everybody's setting up. And there's, I mean, the amount of money that was thrown at this event was, you know, I was sort of almost reeling, you know, the amount of staff, the amount of food, the amount of, you know, there was meals and silver service sort of provided for everybody. Like, and we're just setting up this little store and there's all these people coming in from Denmark, I think, and Germany and places like that. Some sort of business had some sort of business arrangements with the city. And, I happened to meet with this chap who we started to get into a conversation.
Okay. So just be clear, James, are you talking about Aerospace Bristol, this new museum up at Filton?
Yes. Yeah, exactly there. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, so this must have been around about the time it was opening, a couple of years ago, possibly, was it,
yeah,
roughly?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a time. Yeah. And there was this company that brought up loads of scooters with a view to sort of like getting them out onto Bristol streets.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So it's almost like a kind of showcase thing where, it's a private invite thing, but if you've got a business and you're invited there, you can kind of sell the idea to the city civic leaders. Okay, so that was scooters, was it?
Yes, and I couldn't understand, to be quite honest, what the hell we were doing there, because, you know, I mean, these people weren't interested in what we were doing. I mean, it was basically just a free piss up and a free dinner, and, you know, everybody gets to ride on a scooter. You know, okay. That was, yeah, I mean, I couldn't see, you know, I mean, they just needed bodies there, I think, on the ground. And I'm not very good with faces or famous people. I've lived my life, actually, to be quite honest, around famous people, and I've never recognized them. I'm rubbish at that sort of thing. And I met who turned out to be Marvin, the mayor. And being an idiot, we were just standing around waiting for things to sort of happen. And I'd set up my stall and I was just standing around, and there was two women who turned out to be his sort of like, I should imagine they were his handlers, you know. They looked after him.
Okay, you know, like security or something.
No, they were quite attractive, quite nicely dressed, women of about early 30s, quite sort of like businesslike, and they looked after him. You know, and
What do you mean, bringing him drinks or?
Yeah, and, you know, sort of, is there anything I can, you know, I didn't realise that they were together. I thought that these two girls were just two girls that had a stall somewhere. Yeah, I thought they were having had a business thing like that, and I didn't realise that they were with him. And me and this chap, we got into a bit of a conversation, nothing, you know, and he said something that sort of like was about restricting, it got very quickly onto sort of like the subject of free speech. And he said that free speech, you know, speech is violence. And I said, that free speech is a pillar of our society, that without free speech, we wouldn't be here now, you know, without the ability to say and to discuss. And if you don't have free speech, you're basically, the state is trying to control the way you think.
Okay. Yeah. But can you remember what the topic was you were discussing that led on to this, you know, what is free speech and what isn't?
I can't remember exactly how it got onto the free speech thing, but it got there very quickly. And all I said to him was, you know, I said, whatever your political beliefs are, I said, And whatever anybody's political beliefs are, or anybody's feelings, or what anybody's belief, religious beliefs are in here or anywhere in the world, I said, I will fight to the death for their right to have those beliefs and to speak those beliefs. And he called me a fascist. And I was sort of rather stunned. I probably reacted a bit sharpish. Insofar as I come from a council estate, and if so, you know, because when somebody calls you a fascist, right, okay, if you're having a political discussion or anything like that, and the moment they call you a fascist, basically they're shutting the discussion down, because they, anything you say post that statement can be discounted 100% because you're a fascist. If you understand what I'm saying, it just, it's a way of killing it stone dead. Like, it's not discussion. It's a way of, it's the opposite of discussion. It's a way of, it's a trope that they use on the left. It's what I actually said. I said, unless you're incitement to violence or to harm somebody, I said, you should be able to say whatever you want, you know. And, he called me a fascist, and I think I called him an idiot, if you want the God's honest truth. I said, well, you're an idiot then, for, you know, and he walked away about 15 meters away to up the wall and hugged himself like, and looked at the floor. And I thought, my God, there's something wrong with him. And I said to these two girls, I think there's something wrong with him. And they were absolutely in a panic. And I said, I'm going to go and see if he's all right, because I said, he don't look all right to me. And they said, whatever you do, don't go near him. Don't go near him. Like, you know. And next thing I know, that, you know, one of them ran over and literally took, you know, spoke to him for a few minutes and then took him somewhere else. And I thought, well, you know. Anyway, somebody said to me later on, I was at the my store, and they said, are you the chap that upset Marvin? I said, who's Marvin? And he said, the mayor of Bristol. I said, well, I don't know. I said, did I upset Marvin? And he said, yeah, he said, he's that guy you were talking to. I said, oh, is that the mayor of Bristol, is it? I didn't realise that, you know.
So, look, let's be clear, James. I mean, did he have to leave the meeting then and leave the event?
Well, no, it was all show. All that sort of like going away and cuddling yourself and everything like that. That was just, it was like a 14-year-old, you know, it was just basically because I was just saying what he said was wrong. You cannot tell people how to think. You cannot dictate to people what they should do and what they should believe in and everything like that. People should be free to make their own minds up. And basically, you've upset Marvin. It all went round that, you know, the guy from Bristol Blue Glass upset Marvin. Anyway, from that day, I mean, we were having sort of like a stream of emails and things like that between the council. Oh, well, they stopped there and then. Well, the next day they didn't. And we have emailed them and sort of like tried to sort of like, you know, so about this property here and this property there, like, but the answers have been very terse and very, you know, succinct. And, you know, if the only communication we have with them is if we generate it now, they will not automatically get in touch with us or anything like that. It stopped it on a thing. So, I mean, yeah, right. I might have upset Marvin. I did. And it cost me possibility of moving my business into the centre, back into the centre of Bristol again.
So that's James Adlington from Bristol Blue Glass. They're describing this event a couple of years ago, one of these little boondoggles where you get free food, free drinks, you get to meet loads of other business people from around the city. I mean, he goes into it at the end there, Martin, but what James was trying to do was to actually rent some Bristol city council property in the centre here and the emails all just stopped at that point. So it's quite obvious that he's upsetting the mayor, has lost him his opportunities in the city to move his business into the centre.
Well, obviously, I didn't know anything about any of this until I've just heard it.
It's disgusting, isn't it? Absolutely disgusting for a civic leader to, because he doesn't like the cut of somebody's jib, to say, well, you can't come into this city.
Well, I don't know what the detail of what is.
Well, you just heard it.
Yes, I've heard it, and I've heard one version of it. And, of course, we haven't heard from Marvin, as you know.
Yeah, well, because Marvin
would no doubt have his version of events.
Yeah, he might not have his version of events. In fact, I think that's much more likely that there won't be a version of events from Marvin.
Probably not. Certainly not on this.
There is certainly no podcast. No versions of any events for Marvin at all, because as Gary Hopkins explained last week, he only talks to the people he wants to talk to. He only invites to use the facilities of Bristol Property Services, which is a big portfolio handed down to him from hundreds of years of previous civic leaders, to people that don't say things to him like, "I think everyone should have free speech."
Well, I'm not going to defend Marvin or attack Marvin. I heard what James said there.
What about the principles here?
Well, I mean, in principle...
A civic leader runs it as if it's his own fiefdom.
Well, that is how the mayoral system was designed by the Liberal-Tory coalition. He's doing nothing that isn't within his power.
And the Americans.
Yes, it's a US-based system. Marvin is empowered to run the city because he's got a directly elected mandate, and he doesn't have to justify that to anybody. He doesn't have to go on any radio programs or TV programs if he doesn't want to. Maybe he should, but he doesn't. And of course, he rubs them up the wrong way.
Well, it's not whether a political leader will answer questions from journalists.
The only comeback on that is on election day next Thursday. And if he doesn't win...
I can tell you there's more comeback, actually, because there will be discussion about this. I think, you know, what's happened is we've also had the whole issue with Adam Postans being quite clearly and very obviously, even you would admit, bullied in a council meeting. Mm. He's one of the local democracy reporters. And they would say, oh, are there any reporters in the room? Ha, ha, ha. Where he had described something as a council dump when actually it was a waste and recycling centre. Well, the thing is, most of the people in the city still call it a dump. And so Adam is just using the language that most people in the city use, and yet he was ridiculed, bullied and pilloried for that in public by these. I mean, I think there's this almost like cocaine snorting attitude that we've got now in Bristol City Council, where these sort of things are fine. You know, you can just push people around, bully people. There's also the leaving of the Labour Party in droves by some of the councillors that have been bullied by this mayor and this mayor's office. I mean, you can't deny that.
I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that Marvin has ever taken cocaine, Tony.
So well, it's just that attitude.
You're damaging your own case by making that sort of statement.
Well, what I said was, I didn't say he'd taken cocaine, did I? I said it was
cocaine
that sort of
snorting attitude.
Yes, that's right. And that's the sort of attitude you get from arrogant gangsters.
Well, he may be arrogant, but he certainly has there's no evidence to say that he's ever snorted cocaine. And it sounds as if you are not going to vote for him.
Well, what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about how a civic leadership, something which is a democratic system, can be effectively privatised, taken into private hands, and the same sort of attitudes that business leaders will use to run their company for profit, for shareholders, are introduced into a city's own leadership.
The whole concept of elected mayors was in order for them to function more like business leaders. And that's why George Ferguson became the mayor, because he was already a millionaire business leader.
Bristol City Council has been privatised.
No, it hasn't been privatised. It's been messed with by the creation of a mayoral system by the Tories so that they could commercialise the decision-making process. And they basically then took money up away from a city like Bristol, which has got a substantial business rate, means that Marvin then becomes in the pocket of the business community rather than having an elected council like the Greater London Council, which would be run on a party political basis.
The reason I talk about cocaine is because we just just had a few weeks ago, Bristol Waste, about, I think it was about a year ago, were accused by one of their employees of having regular snorting of cocaine on their by their employees. And she was then, she was sacked. She had all sorts of other accusations about being bullied by the Bristol Waste employees. Now, this is a company which is directly managed by the people who are appointed by Bristol City Council. It's one of these arm's length companies which is proving to be rather a disaster, particularly where I am in St Paul's, with the waste not being collected for weeks and massive amounts of fly tipping going on, systems not working for local residents who are trying to get rubbish that's been dumped in the street moved. So those accusations we've heard just in the last few weeks have all been just thrown out. So there's no apparent evidence for it, and there's nothing going to be done about it, even if it was true. But these employees that have accused the Bristol Waste of this are sticking to their guns. They're saying, well, that's the way it is. There seems to be just a complete denial to dealing with, what is effectively these private fiefdoms that have been created, particularly Bristol Energy, which has now lost £50 million of public money, and Bristol Waste, which is simply not doing its job.
Well, I hear what you say, Tony, but it's a bit of a smorgasbord of stuff. Low-level employees in Bristol Waste using cocaine on the job is not the direct responsibility of the elected mayor.
Well, it's the responsibility of the mayor to make sure that these things are dealt with, surely.
Well, maybe it is, and you could argue that he hasn't done what was necessary in that case. You could argue that Bristol Waste is badly managed. You could argue that Bristol Energy is badly managed. You could say that Marvin is
everything in this city has
been... That's all freedom of speech,
everything in this city has been deregulated. You can just do what you want now.
That's not the case, Tony. You know as well as I do that where we're sitting here in St Paul's, there are people taking cocaine all over the place, just around the corner around here. Bristol has got a major drugs issue, always has had, going back to the 1960s. It's probably one of the places in the country where it's easiest to cut around. And of course, Fangham Debonair, the Labour MP for Bristol West, is in favour of decriminalising and legalising drugs, as I am.
Well, as the Lib Dems are, for example.
Indeed. In other words, the world is moving on this.
Isn't it transform in this city that says these things should be decriminalised? But that doesn't mean to say you should be using them on the job when you're working for Bristol Waste.
That's a work discipline issue, isn't it?
Yeah, but anyway,
you're not allowed to drink on the job
point
either.
My point is it's all just been thrown out. Anyway, there's probably more important issue, which is homelessness, and that's another massive thing that's going on at the moment here. We're about to have a whole load of extra homeless people just after the election. How convenient is that? Thrown onto the streets. We've got a lot of people in one of the traveller sites, which I visited last week, who are now having to pay to be there, although... The site was originally opened up in Hengrove in order to house overflow from the various traveller sites. But anyway, to add to all of this, we've now got about 50 people in 6 weeks or so's time are going to be thrown onto the streets who have been being housed by money from central government, not by the city council, who are supposed to be, I mean, certainly, you know, I would have thought were supposed to be in charge of housing. They're not, apparently, now. What they do is they pay people to get on a train and leave the city, rather than house them. And so there was a report on ITV West last night about this new load of people, 50, who are about to be made homeless in the city at the end of the pandemic and after the election.
ITV News has been told the number of homeless people living on Bristol streets could increase dramatically unless emergency accommodation can be found within a few weeks. Charities caring for some of the city's most vulnerable say the end of government support during the pandemic could force more than 50 people to join those already sleeping rough. Here's Richard Payne.
They are the hidden homeless, not yet on the streets, but without a place to call their own. Damien was sleeping on friends' sofas before being placed in emergency accommodation when COVID hit.
How has it been for you the last few months, knowing that you've got a roof over your head at least?
Awesome. It's been fabulous. It has been the best opportunity I've received lately.
He's one of 60 people who'll be ordered out of their temporary accommodation when government support ends on May the 17th to coincide with the lifting of most COVID restrictions. The Julian Trust charity will meet the costs of a few, but more than 50 face homelessness.
I fear being on the street in a month's time because because I've never been in such situation, so it's frightening. It's very frightening. I don't know how people are used to it, because I cannot fathom my head around it.
Charities like Caring in Bristol have stepped in to feed nearly 1,000 of the city's most vulnerable, some of whom have no claim to any benefits or other support, such as asylum seekers. Others who help provide a safe place to live fear what the next month will expose.
The last year has revealed us something that we always knew, but perhaps our partners in the council didn't know. We are concerned that there is a large number of people that are coming our way. We know who they are. We're expecting it. We don't have the provision right now. We need the people of Bristol to step up to help us meet this need.
Immigration lawyers are also involved, but say finding solutions for those most in need will be a long and complicated task.
Bristol City Council have had to make a very expensive intervention in housing and feeding these people during the pandemic. But it's quite interesting. This problem has been there all along. It's just the pandemic has brought this into relief. It's good that now we're focusing on the issue, and hopefully we can come up with some solutions to it.
But time is fast running out, and while lockdown is easing, the search for a place to call home for some looks set to become even more difficult. Richard Payne, ITV News, Bristol.
OK, so we're about to get another 50 people dumped onto the streets of Bristol, Martin.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a huge, as these furlough schemes and other pandemic measures are wound down over the summer, there's going to be a big hit for the people at the bottom of the pile, it's quite clear.
Well, they're having nice little boondoggles entertaining people who want to sell scooters, but the idea of housing homeless people doesn't seem to be very high up the priorities of Bristol City Council anymore.
It's not high up the priorities of the central government.
Well, what about the council?
Well, the council is building
council housing, but it's not actually housing the homeless.
No.
Surely that's the first stage, is that you find somewhere for homeless people, even if it's a hostel, whatever. But before you're actually getting around to building council housing...
Well, the selling off of council housing stock from the 1980s onward was always going to create a generation without a stake in the society.
£50 million, you know how many houses you could build for £50 million?
Yeah. You could argue that the council has wasted money on Bristol Waste, Bristol Energy. Those are separate questions. The homelessness problem in this country is virtually 100% the fault of conservative central governments who will not build social housing because they know that people in social housing do not tend to vote for them.
So do you know why Paul Smith, who was in charge of housing, resigned? He didn't resign, apparently.
No, he didn't.
Retired.
No, but he said he didn't resign. He said he was moving to another
job.
But
I don't agree with him.
No?
I think he was just being, shall we say, polite to say that he didn't resign, because that would have been embarrassing for the Labour Party. But he's gone on to do a housing association because he just wanted to build homes, particularly affordable housing. That was his mission, and he couldn't actually do it within Bristol City Council. Mm. I mean, I just think the Labour Party in this city is completely sold out. I think, you know, in some ways, it's become just like Keir Starmer in national politics. It's just blue Labour.
Well, you may say that, but in actual fact, the Labour Party in Bristol West, of which I'm a member, is one of the most left-wing it's got the most left-wing membership in the country and one of the highest memberships in the country.
Why is it bullying all of the anti-Semites? Why has the Labour Party main office taken over control so that the members don't have any say anymore? Martin, let me finish the sentence. So that the members don't have any say anymore who runs Bristol West Labour Party.
The regional office have taken over Bristol West Labour Party precisely because it isn't pro-Starmer, precisely because it isn't in the pocket of the central Labour machine.
There's a bit control freakery going on.
Yes, there is control freakery going on. There's about to be an election for the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party. It's the first time they've ever had an election, but it's not the members of the party won't be allowed to vote, just as the members of the Reform Party, which is run by Farage, don't get a vote in who the candidates are.
People do judge political parties by how democratic they are, don't they? And the Labour Party is certainly in Bristol West is not very democratic.
No, what you've got is a struggle within the Labour Party between the left wing, which is the membership, and the structure, which is basically controlled by the money masters, that is to say, the unions and the business people who support the Labour Party.
So at the end of the day, what are the homeless people supposed to do? Just stay sleeping on the streets? No, they won't be voting Labour, will they?
Well, they won't be voting for anybody because they won't be on the electoral register.
Yeah, well, maybe they won't be voting for anybody, no. But would you be voting for, if you were them? Do you think that Labour would be able to deliver some homes for them?
Well, I don't think...
Is there any point in voting if you're homeless?
No, there is if you can get a vote. But the alternatives to voting Labour are to vote Lib Dem, who were actually brought in the whole austerity policy, which has created so much homelessness. You could vote Tory, the people who privatised the council house system. Or you could vote to the left of the Labour Party for the Green Party or the Trade Union Socialist Alliance. And you can do that because you can transfer your vote to the Labour Party to keep the Liberal Party, who went into coalition with the Tories, and the Tories, who are truly responsible for the homelessness crisis in this country over 40 years, keep them out. And, of course, you should use your vote if you've got one.
When you say you're using a transfer vote, we talked to Gary Hopkins about this last week. So you can vote mainly for one person and you can use another vote for somebody else if you want to.
Yeah.
But there's really not any point in voting for the minor candidates because they're definitely not going to win, are they?
Well, no, you can vote for a minor candidate because that will show what the lie of the land is. But if you vote with your second vote, you've got to use it. As in France, this is the normal system in France. You get two votes. You vote in the first place for what you really want, and then you vote in the second place to keep out what you don't really want. And if you don't do that, you end up with a minority candidates, which happens under first past the post all the time. And of course, Priti Patel wants to get rid of the transfer vote for mayors so that you could end up with a situation where mayors end up having total power in a city with, a fraction of the popular vote, maybe as low as 30 or 20%, which of course is not democratic.
But you voted for this Keir Starmer guy, didn't you?
I did, because I couldn't see that.
But I voted with
no delusions.
Do you think he conned you?
Not really, because I was pretty much clear what he was going to do, and he's done everything wrong from my point of view since he was elected. But I didn't. What I hoped would happen is he would recognise that he needed to bring the different wings of the party together.
Well,
that's not
going to
happen.
He was never going to do that, was he?
Well, he could have done. He chose not to.
He's also the director of public prosecutions who horrendously put the two prosecutions of Jimmy Savile by Surrey Police in the bin, rather conveniently. So he strikes me as a sort of guy who's a bit like, I mean, you should have known this, Martin. In fact, you did know it. Like Kamala Harris, who's been put into politics because they've been a public prosecutor who's been in the pocket of the criminals.
I would say that to say he's in the pocket of the criminals is an extreme statement.
Well, it wasn't just one prosecution by Surrey Police against Jimmy Savile for paedophilia. It was two. I mean, if he could have a look at one and he said, well, there's not enough evidence. But they brought another one along and he binned that one too. This is all while Savile was still alive, by the way.
Yeah. What you could say about Keir Starmer is he's very much an establishment figure, quite opposite to Jeremy Corbyn, who was regarded as a non-establishment figure. You're not going to find people from the army, for example, briefing off the record saying we won't accept Starmer as prime minister. And that, unfortunately, is the situation in a first-past-the-post setup where 44% of people voted Tory at the last election, but they get 80%, they get an 80-seat majority. That's not acceptable in any other country in Europe. It wouldn't happen. And in actual fact, since 1979, if we'd had a proportional system, there would have never have been a Tory government. So there would never have been any council house privatisation. None at all. And what happens in this country is we've got a forelock tugging, deferential situation where the majority have always voted against the Tories. We lose every time because the system's rigged, and then we all go home and say, well, what can we do about it? In Northern Ireland, in the 1960s, they know what they did about it. They went to war. And that's what happens in many countries.
They started doing peaceful marches. That's what they started doing in
Northern
Ireland.
Yes, and then they got shot down.
Yeah, they got shot by on Bloody Sunday by a parachute regiment.
And the first bomb attack was actually carried out by the Ulster Volunteer Force as a false flag, which was blamed on the official IRA. Now, this is the problem. What is going to happen as we go forward? What will probably happen next on Thursday, this just guessing what the way the results will play out, looking at the opinion polls, is it'll be very similar to the result in the general election of 2019. So the Tories will get about 40% of the vote, but because it's all first past the post, apart from situations where you've got to transfer a vote in
yeah, I don't think cities. These opinion polls are really worth that much, are they? We saw with Trump and Brexit, they just got it completely wrong.
Well, no,
they did.
Well, what will happen is that the majority of the people who go out to vote will vote against the Tories.
They were even saying today, talking about Boris Johnson, apparently during this flat thing that's been going around the media, that his opinion poll lead has gone up one over Keir Starmer this week. So I don't know if I believe these.
Yeah, but even if that's the case, Tony, the fact is that the Tories are a minority in this country. And if we had a proportional system like in Ireland, Scotland, Denmark, France, any of the local countries around us, or any other country in Europe or Eastern Europe, they wouldn't be the government.
You rail against the system, but if Jeremy Corbyn, for example, had embraced Brexit, and Jeremy Corbyn had dealt with the anti-Semitism allegations in his own party properly by actually getting rid of fake anti-Semitism, that you may well have won that last election.
What Corbyn should have done is committed himself, as the New Zealand Labour Party did in the 1980s, to proportional representation, and then he could have formed a coalition with the SNP,
he could do that once,
Cymru,
possibly,
and so on.
He could possibly do that once he's in power, who knows.
Well,
but anyway,
he could have made it a central part of his manifesto. He chose not to. That was stupid. I tried to pin him down on it when he first stood for leadership in the Labour Party.
You know, I think it's much more to do with Brexit. The last general election was almost a vote based on Brexit.
Yeah, but yes, and of course, 44% voted for the Tories on the basis that they wanted Brexit, but 57% voted for parties that called for a second referendum. You haven't actually got a majority in favour of Brexit in this country.
Well, I don't believe that at all.
I think that's true.
In fact, if you look at, for example, the Brexit vote itself, it was the highest turnout we've ever seen. Everything was going, the turnouts were going down and down and down.
Yes,
people decided actually.
At the time,
just a minute, Martin, stop shouting over me, please. What I'm trying to say here is that at the time, this was the issue which everyone wanted to vote on, and they weren't being given it. And when the Brexit referendum happened, they were.
Yes, and in Scotland they voted to remain in the EU as they did
in
Northern
Ireland.
And in Wales
they remained where they wanted to leave.
There's going to be another election in Wales next Thursday, and a majority will definitely be elected who want to remain in the European Union under a proportional system. So ultimately we're talking about the breakup of the UK.
Well,
not necessarily a bad thing.
Maybe, and actually the polls are going in the opposite direction in Scotland, that people are actually wanting to remain in Britain.
We shall see.
Rather than
the other
way
around.
Well, you can make these shouty assertions, but you have to actually, you know, base them in fact. What we're going to do now is look at these, look across the Bristol Channel now to some real politicians. Now, this guy's name, I met him last year. He was a fascinating guy to have a chat with outside the Senedd, which is the Welsh Parliament. His name's Neil McEvoy. He's exposed, first of all, corruption within the Labour Party in Wales, horrific stuff, and then corruption within Plaid Cymru, which was the party he chose afterwards. And then eventually he was thrown out of Plaid Cymru. He actually made them throw him out. So he's about the only independent-minded and probably the last real politician left in Wales. And so let's have a listen now to a piece that Neil McEvoy put together this week about politics, the other side of the Bristol Channel in Cardiff.
Let me give you an example. This is the first time I was threatened to be expelled from Plaid Cymru. It was a budget deal, and not the one in 2012, which benefited ACT, one of the clients of Derrin. We spoke about them earlier, the former vice chair of Plaid Cymru's company. Not that budget deal, which benefited them. But the budget deal of 2016, I went into a Plaid Cymru meeting, the group meeting, and I wasn't really happy with the deal, and I was told that I had to vote for it and agree it and let the Labour budget go through, because the party had written up a press release and it said it was a unanimous decision. So they did the press release before the meeting, and which was typical of Plaid Cymru, because what would shock people is, and especially if any Plaid members are listening to this, we didn't discuss anything that was coming up in the in the debating chamber, in the Senedd. It wasn't discussed. You just had to vote for it. There was no discussion. And that's the way that Leanne Wood ran Plaid Cymru, and I think Adam Price has continued to run it that way. I've never been in any elected group which has behaved that way ever before. Even the Labour Party used to discuss things. The result was already known, but at least you discuss it. Anyway, we're having this discussion about the historic deal between Plaid and Labour, and it was great. And I did my homework, and I'd done my sums. So I said to the leadership, OK, I said, can you just confirm that the deal is 0.71% of the overall Welsh budget? And they looked at me, and they looked at each other, and they said, yes, that's right. I said, OK, good, OK, we've established that. It's zero, so we're talking about a deal worth 0.71% of the budget. OK, it's historic, fine, great. Can you tell me, before I sign up to this, what is in the 99.29%? And the answer the leadership of Plaid gave me was that they couldn't. So they signed up to a deal themselves, and they wanted me to sign up to a deal where they didn't know 99.29% of what was in it. So their excuse was, well, Mark, you know, not Drakeford or whoever, the finance minister at the time, it was Mark, oh, but Mark wouldn't tell us. And I'm like, what? That's not my fault, you know. And then Adam Price said, well, if you don't sign up for this, I'm going to resign. And he pulled that one before. You know, he's going to resign as finance spokesperson. I thought, well, do you know what? I'm not falling for it again. I said, Adam, listen, mate, if you want to resign, resign. I don't care. And then Leanne Wood said, oh, you get out the party, get out, why don't you just leave Plaid Cymru? I'm like, wow, leave? All I'm saying is, why sign up to a deal when you don't know 99.29% of it? It's hardly radical. And I remember saying to Leanne then at the time, Leanne Wood was the leader of Plaid Cymru then, if you want to get rid of me, Leanne, I said, you're going to have to expel me. And that's what they did.
So that's Neil McAvoy, the last real politician left in Wales. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have some over here in England too? And actually really sticking up for the people who are voting for him. I hope he does very well next week. Neil is standing in Cardiff, and he will be in for the Senedd. And, you know, he's incredibly popular. Martin, what he's really exposing there is that these political parties in Wales are totally bent, I'm afraid, Plaid Cymru and your Labour Party too. And they're actually doing deals with PR firms, big business, and with each other behind the backs of the voters.
Well, I presume he's going to be standing as an independent, is he? Or is he standing...
Well, they've got his own party, actually, and there are various people who follow that
party. What's his party called?
I think it's called Propel.
Propel.
Yes. Yeah, he wanted to start something called the Welsh Nationalist Party, something like that, mm-hmm. Which is a sort of English version of Plaid Cymru. But there was some legal challenge to it, and he couldn't. So they've got to call it anyway. Yes, it's an independent party, which is, I suppose, it's a little bit like Piers Corbyn in London. You know, I suppose standing to say, well, actually, we think the present political parties are bent, and we need a kind of new wave of politics in the country.
Well, because the Senedd election is going to be on a proportional basis, he may have a chance to be elected.
Well, he certainly stands a very good chance. He's a very popular Senedd member in Cardiff.
Well, in that case, that's
he stood in there, of course, for Labour in the past and Plaid in the past, so they know who they're voting for, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's because the Welsh Assembly, like the Scottish Parliament or the Northern Ireland Assembly, is elected on a proportional basis, which does allow people to break away and set up new parties, and they've got some chance of being elected. The problem with the first-past-the-post system is that it basically rigs the system in favour of the elite party, the Conservative Party, which has run this country for the last 200 years. Well, that's what it's designed to do.
Talking of the Conservatives, I thought we'd have a little look at Chippenham this week. A city about 20 miles to the east of Bristol, maybe 25, I'm not absolutely sure. Yeah, probably 25 miles east of Bristol on the railway up to London. And they have the most horrendous trouble there. It's a completely Conservative area, generally speaking, with the local council, plus with quite a lot of Lib Dems too. But what's been going on is the big developers, like they've been doing here in Bristol with our very own Labour so-called Mayor Marvin Rees, is just doing what they want over the last few years, with the planners and the speculators just getting maps in, I suppose, not in the pub, I suppose this would be in a boardroom or in a Masonic lodge, and drawing up a map saying, right, we're going to be building all over this bit and that bit, and then trying to force it through. Anyway, Steve Perry is part of a group, a growing group actually in Chippenham, which is fighting against these planning systems. And what they're trying to do is build a new ring road around the east side of Chippenham and then use that, of course, as a springboard to build an extra 5,000 and some say even 7,000 new homes, which are nothing like the actual original homes in Chippenham. It's a you know, nice old market town, even though it doesn't have a market anymore, and it was built with beautiful Bath stone, a lot of it. But of course, these new places are more like Lego blocks. Anyway, so let's have a listen to Steve Perry, who explains what they'll be fighting for in the elections in Chippenham next week.
The majority of Chippenham is either concrete or bricks, and it's not kept the character of the town. But that's not really the point. The point that I'm making and that I am making politically is that, you know, Wiltshire Council want to dump an additional 5,000. Well, they've actually retracted it now, but they were trying to dump an extra 5,000 houses above and beyond what the government wanted through their algorithm to put in Wiltshire. And they were dumping more than 25% of the whole of Wiltshire's requirement for the government required housing in Chippenham. And the reason for that is because Swindon is no longer technically in Wiltshire. It's its own unitary authority, and Wiltshire Council don't get income from Swindon. So they want somewhere that's going to make that up for them. And 10 years ago or so, they announced, without any consultation with the electorate in Chippenham, that Chippenham was going to be I can't remember what they call it now. It's like a primary town. They've got three of them. Where when the government says we want 60,000 houses, the three primary towns get 20,000 houses each, or roughly, and then a few houses are dotted around the countryside to make up the numbers. Principal settlement is the expression that they use for that. They didn't ask if anybody that lived in Chippenham, if they wanted to be a principal settlement. We're technically now not a market town, although they still claim we are. Because we're a principal settlement. The other two are Salisbury and Trowbridge. You know, they just want to build, and they just seem to be in cohorts with the developers. I don't know if you're aware, but developers have got unbuilt planning permissions for 1.2 million homes in this country, and yet they've managed to convince the government that planning rules and laws are preventing them from building the houses that are required.
Well, hang on. So they've got all these unbuilt planning permissions, but they want more planning. Now, that sounds to me as if the developers are really taking the mickey, but more importantly, that they think that they can make more profit if the planning rules are relaxed. So they can get new permissions, which will be a higher profit margin. So they don't even have to bother building the houses they've already got planning permission for. They can then start with a whole new higher profit margin, more relaxed planning tranche.
Well, the reason they're not building the 1.2 million that they've got planning permission for already is because they land bank. One of the developers local to me used to run, or the three directors of the developer used to run a company called Landbank PLC. You know, its name kind of says it all.
Well,
really.
What is land banking?
Land banking is when developers get permission for land, for building on land, for an estate, for example. They dig a trench, which means they've started development, which means that the planning that's been granted can't lapse. Because they've started the development, and then they don't do anything on it for however many years they want to not do anything on it, because all the time they're not building, the land is increasing in value. And they, you know, and by not building, they're actually keeping up the price of the secondhand market and the new house market as well. Because they're not flooding the market with the homes that, people apparently need. That's notwithstanding the fact that not only have we got those 1.2 million houses or dwellings, I should say, that there are existing planning permissions for, there's also over a million empty homes in this country, which nobody seems to think too much about either.
I don't understand is that, sorry, that's Steve Perry from Chippenham, is we've got a million empty homes, over a million houses with planning permission. Why have we even got a housing crisis?
Because it's by design. The property owning classes are basically being bribed by, you know, they're being given free money by the government effectively to vote Tory. And of course, the losers are the people at the bottom of the pile who will never get on the housing ladder, who cannot get anywhere but decent
even
to live.
Even Labour was saying that if people have got property they want to pass on to their children, that they will be taxed. And of course, if you're going to tax a house that you want to pass on to your kids after you die, that means that they might have to sell the house. In fact, it's highly likely that you're going to have to sell the house anyway to pay the tax, and then you can't pass the house on. So why is Labour doing that? I mean, the Conservatives actually lost a fantastic amount of support when Theresa May announced a similar sort of plan to get people to pay for their social care, wasn't it? Elderly social care. So the idea that you can't... Should you be able to pass your house on to your kids or not?
It depends, Tony, doesn't it?
Why should your house be taken off you when you die, then?
Adult social care in Scotland does not depend on your... You don't have to sell your house in order to get adult social care. In Britain, in England, you do. And ultimately, of course, this is a big problem which no government has able to grasp.
They keep saying they're going to do it, and they never do.
Yeah, well, they never do, because, of course, it means dealing with vested interests.
It does seem to me that the housing thing is right at the centre of everything in many ways, because, you know, it's like when all the rest of the economy collapses, you know that people will need a roof over their head, and they are desperate to pay probably more money than they'll pay for anything else to get a roof over their head.
Well, as we speak, house prices in this country are rocketing upwards. We're in the middle of a pandemic. There's a potential. There's been a recession, but house prices are rising because the government have had a stamp duty holiday, which I think they're going to extend. So the furlough scheme for people who work is going to be withdrawn. The stamp duty holiday is going to remain, which is free money for developers. And the developers are the big funders of the Tory party. Many Tory MPs are themselves landlords. So, for example, we've had 5 votes in the House of Commons about people who've got cladding similar to the Grenfell Tower cladding, and they've found out that they've got to deal with it themselves. The landowners and the landlords are not going to deal with it, and the Tory party, with their 80-seat majority, have refused to do anything to help those people. And that's because they represent the landowning classes. Now, ultimately, you could argue, and in some countries in Scandinavia it is the case, you can pass a house to your children, but nobody is allowed to have 2 houses or 3 houses. And of course, that's the sort of thing that Plaid Cymru's talking about in North Wales, where locals cannot get anywhere to live, and people are basically buying up second houses in the villages, which locals cannot afford. Ultimately,
well, that's largely because they can't pass them on.
Well, you are in favour of no inheritance taxes, Tony. Is that correct?
No, I'm not saying that at all. No, but you shouldn't be taxed on handing a house on. I mean, what's going to happen there in Wales is that you're going to get a load of rich people from London buying up all your property, isn't it?
Yeah,
and that's what happens all over the country.
Ultimately, of course, what you need to have is a substantial council house sector, which is what we used to have, which made it much, but then took
but we
the,
haven't got
took
it, have we?
No, because it was taken away 40 years ago, and that's
What's
why
happening?
We're
well,
in
I'm
the mess we're in.
Well, what I'm trying to say here is that you've got an increasing problem with housing, is that young people simply can't afford anywhere to live, and that's exemplified there in Chippenham, as the guy was just saying, is that you've got the house prices are so high that even though they've got permissions, and even though they're looking for whatever it is, another 5,000 homes, those homes might not necessarily be built unless they think they can sell them at the high prices they want.
That's right, and it's of no use whatsoever to the people at the bottom of the pile who've got nowhere to live. Totally pointless.
Okay, so anyway, this was discussed on Points West. By the way, Points West did a, this is our local BBC here in Bristol, did a debate between the various mayor candidates last Sunday. So I put that up on YouTube. If you want to get an idea of some of these people you might be voting for, who they are, what they look like, what they say, you can find that, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because on the iPlayer it may still be there, but on the actual page itself, where the show was supposed to be from last Sunday, it disappeared after 24 hours, which I thought was a little bit rich. It should at least have been there until the election if people wanted to watch it. So here's a little excerpt now about housing. And here's our mayor, Marvin Rees, who doesn't like me and doesn't want to come on our programme, but he will come on, of course, the BBC. And here he is talking about housing.
You all want to build more homes. Marvin Rees, you said, I interviewed you when you got elected last time, you said, judge me, David, on housing. Well, you haven't hit your targets, have you?
No, we haven't managed to hit the 800 a year affordable, but we've delivered 9,000 homes and trebled the number of affordable homes built during that time. And we've done it in the face of some major challenges, COVID and Brexit and austerity in the background as well. So I think people recognise that we've transformed the city's image on housing. Certainly our national reputation is enhanced, which is why BlockLock have chosen Bristol to be the first city in the UK in which they've invested. So I think BlockLock. It's an off-site manufactured housing firm from Scandinavia. Right. First time they've invested in the UK.
I thought you were being rude then, Mark.
No, I'm not. But, there are families across the city, individuals who have homes now, and I visit them. And I think you can just see the cranes on the horizon. There has been delivery.
But you admit you haven't hit the targets that you said you would.
We didn't hit the 800 affordable, no.
Yeah, so it's that expression, cranes on the horizon, we keep hearing from Marvin. It's just, the only thing is that they're building loads and loads of student accommodation with these tiny little boxes, or else office accommodation, which is a great deal of dubiousness over whether it's actually needed. And all it's going to do is, maybe people might move in there from other businesses in other parts of town, then leave other office buildings empty. But there's certainly no desperate need at all for new office buildings around the city. Anyway, so he hasn't hit the housing targets, Martin.
No. And he's given various excuses why not. Ultimately, it's central government policy that determines what local councils can do. And if it isn't, is it?
No,
well,
it isn't. That's why Bristol set up its own organisation to build council houses.
Yes.
And to finance them. So it was independent of government.
Yep. And they should have achieved more than they have. But what makes you think that anybody else in the position would do a better job?
The developers lean on councils and they lean on people because they're saying, well, look, we don't want all these cheap housing. We want people to have to pay over the odds for their housing because we're going to make a profit out of it.
Yes, that's right. And it's virtually, there is no priority on providing low cost housing to low income people. And don't forget that the whole political strategy of the Conservative hegemony is to keep the first past the post system, to push house prices up in the marginal constituencies where the few 100,000 voters are that determine British general elections, make sure their house prices are rising, which of course is money for nothing.
And when Labour has control of a city for 5 years, it builds virtually no council.
Yes, and when Labour is in government for 13 years, they didn't reverse the privatisation of the council housing sector.
So you're really voting for Labour whether you vote, you're voting Tory, whether you vote Labour
or
Tory.
Yes, and of course the only way round that is to have a proportional system, so a left-wing breakaway from the Labour Party, as is possible in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland,
We've got that here with the Trade Union Socialist Coalition in Bristol. People can vote for that if they want.
Well, they can. They can. But, of course, they're not necessarily going to win because they haven't got the same kind of media profile as mainstream parties.
I think it will be certainly a very fascinating election anyway next Thursday. What with all the polls? I mean, you usually find that the day of the election results, all the polls get torn up. But particularly because of the strong feelings running in these various protest movements, Martin, aren't there? With Black Lives Matter, we've got Extinction Rebellion on climate. We've also got the anti-lockdown people and the Kill the Bill people. So I would suggest that you've got quite a lot of people from the Kill the Bill. I mean, this is certainly anecdotally, I've heard that a lot of Kill the Bill marchers went along last Saturday in London for the big anti-lockdown march. But do you think that these four particular protests and other protest movements are going to make a difference in these local elections and in the Scottish and the Welsh elections?
Well, in Bristol, I think the Green Party will do quite well, and they may even do well enough to topple Marvin because of the transfer vote. If there's no transfer vote, that wouldn't be possible.
But it's interesting hearing from Saf there that they're supporting the Lib Dems. As he was on his way out, he's saying that they're distributing it around the cabs, that they want to vote Lib Dem to get rid of the mayor system. And that does seem to be certainly talking to other people around the city. There's quite a lot of people who may actually... Because the Lib Dems ran the city, didn't they, up until 2012 when George Ferguson took over?
Yeah, they did, but then they went into coalition with the Tory government, if you remember.
Well, at Westminster, but not...
Yeah, I know, but that made a huge difference to their
It probably brought their vote down here, as Gary pointed out. We have not gone into any coalitions here in Bristol, the Lib Dems here.
Yeah, I know,
and they've got no power over what Nick Clegg does.
No, I know, but at the same time, I mean, they used to have 50-some-odd MPs, and they're down to 8. I think they bitterly, if they've got any sense, they bitterly regret going into coalition with the Tories.
They've
not entirely lived that down, I'm afraid.
No, you're quite right. But here in Bristol, I think that they seem to be on the up. They've been at the centre of some of the major legal challenges, for example, to Marvin Rees, particularly over children with special educational needs. Now, that was a pretty horrific saga, wasn't it, where you've got the City Council actually breaking the law in not doing what it has to legally do in order to educate kids in special schools.
Well, not just in special schools, special needs kids in ordinary schools as well. And that's because the central government doesn't provide the money for that particular provision.
Well, that's just not the case. They have allocated it to other things.
No,
they found the money eventually once they had a legal challenge.
No, you cannot. The central government doesn't cover that cost. So if the more special needs education you fund as a local council, the less money you've got for other things.
Well, like what? Like
anything.
What, like free drinks for the scooter people?
Okay, yes, all right.
And trips to China.
Yes, and all the other
Malaysia,
things.
Malaysia.
Yes.
And having a parliament of mayors from all over the world flown into Bristol.
Yes. Well, ultimately, another thing that's happened, if we're talking about schools this week.
And £50 million down the drain with Bristol Energy. I mean, you know, this is about priorities, isn't it? And obviously, disabled kids are not a priority.
They're not a priority for central government either, Tony. And
they could be a priority here, and they're not, and they weren't. And well, they were legally caught out.
Yes, they were caught out, and they've now, you know, as you know, I work in this sector, and I'm very well aware of what the problems are. The central government is more interested in pushing free money to homeowners to vote Tory than it is to providing special needs education. There's been a 10-year austerity policy caused by the bailout of the banks, which collapsed as a result of deregulation brought in by the Conservative Party in the 1980s.
That is driving a great wedge through the country and exacerbating the gap between rich and poor.
Of course it is. And that's what we're dealing with. And of course,
the Labour Party as an alternative is not going to deal with it, and it isn't dealing with it, is it?
The Labour Party as an alternative isn't enough. We need a change in the political system, followed by a change in the social system. And ultimately, of course, that is going to be a bigger change than just changing
Maybe to start with, we could do with a little bit of democracy here in Bristol rather than a dictatorship, which is what was warned of before George Ferguson and the mayor system came along back in 2012. Anyway, we've got all sorts of lobbies, so we're twisting the arms of all of our politicians, apart from pretty much everybody, it seems, apart from Neil McAvoy over in the Senedd in Cardiff. And I thought I'd have a little look at this, because we've had a few weeks ago, we had an interview about the Bristol sociology professor David Miller, who is going through some sort of disciplinary procedure because he said that the Jewish groups at the universities are part funded by the Israeli state, by the Israeli government, and apparently that was anti-Semitic. So he's being going through a whole hoop of arguments over whether that is going to get him sacked from his job. But anyway, I noticed that with all this privatisation that's been going on, particularly the NHS and all these jobs given to other groups, private friends of the Tory party doing NHS work, that we go back to a video which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, right from I think it was 2010 or 2011 when the Conservatives first got in with the Lib Dem coalition government with David Cameron running the place after Gordon Brown, and because there was an enormous push right back then to get healthcare privatised. And of course, that's gone a long way down the road now with all this massive amounts of money going to these private vaccine companies, for example. So here's David Miller talking about the lobbies and particularly about the city, but also we've heard about the Uber lobby. We've heard about the housing lobby. We've been talking about lobbies almost since we started. So here he is, Professor David Miller now from 10 years ago, talking about the lobbies.
Lobbying is a huge industry. The offices around where we're standing now are full of lobbyists of all sorts and stripes. And they are engaged in an attempt to manage the political process. Now, they can't do that without having contacts with people inside politics, with ministers, civil servants, MPs, members of the House of Lords. And that means, of course, that they want to get very close to them. So what happens often is that the people will move from working as a Labour Party researcher or as a Tory Party spin doctor into a think tank or a lobbying agency as part of their career progression. They might then move back and become an MP or a special advisor, or then maybe they become a minister. And then at the end of the ministerial career, they might then move swiftly off into a sinecure with a big healthcare corporation, like, for example, Patricia Hewitt did with Boots. So you have this kind of revolving door where people move from lobbying to regulation to lobbying to regulation again. And there's a cosy culture which grows up as a result of that, where the attempt to actually change minds is not really very important, because all the minds have already been changed by this revolving door process, where they all start to think in the same way and start to believe that the corporation's interests are the only interests worth paying attention to. So you've got this culture of corruption, so institutional corruption inside the decision-making bodies of Parliament and Westminster and Whitehall.
Well, it's not just there, it's also here in Bristol City Council. Institutional corruption, Martin, he's saying that's effectively what's going on here, is that these donations, the monies, unofficial favours that are going to politicians here in Bristol and in Westminster are really just there so that the corporations can get their way. And that, as soon as the election's done with, the politicians, most of them, are just forgetting about the public that voted for them.
Well, they've got two constituencies to whom they're accountable. They have to win the election, and to win elections you do need money, and the corporations and the other interested parties provide the money, and then they expect to get their pound of flesh. And of course, in Scandinavian countries, the political parties are funded by the state, and only on the basis of what the political party itself got, the percentage of the vote they got at the last election. And of course they have a proportional system, which is why you've got, you know, Finland run by a left-wing government with a social democrat woman leader who's in her 30s, but she has to form a coalition with the Greens and other progressive forces. And that would be the norm in a normal North European country. But we're not a normal North European country. We're a hand-me-down version of the United States.
Well, it's not just hand-me-down either, is it? I mean, effectively, there's all sorts of reasons why. I was fascinated to see, as soon as the Americans say we want to pull out of Afghanistan, the British just said how high.
Well, in actual fact, the British Army moaned about it and said they didn't agree with it, but they can't really stay on their own. And why we're there in the first place is another question.
Are they taking money for drugs?
Well, the US, the CIA certainly is. And
it's a massive opium growing area.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, it was the Taliban were stopping the growing of opium. Yeah. Now, it's the heroin's all over the place, and they're making a fortune out of this.
Yes, that's right. And of course, what they do is they use that funding to fund various black ops that they carry out around the world. The political system in the West is effectively an oligarchy. It's a democratic facade. There's a vote, but it's not a free and fair vote, and the system is rigged in favour of conservative parties, which are most favourable to corporate interests. And the only way you can compete with them is by having opposition parties who are also themselves flagging up that they are not against the vested interests. That's what Keir Starmer's all about. He's there to calm down those who think that the Labour Party might carry out some radical policies, to make them feel that it's safe to allow him to be the Prime Minister. And that's to do with the way the system is structured. It's been designed, it was designed hundreds of years ago to keep the oligarchy in power. It's the same as the Roman Republic. There were elections, but effectively the big families ran.
But it hasn't actually always been like that. It's been definitely going down in my lifetime, and there's been much more pressure. For example, I mean, what we were talking about the houses, this whole idea of stopping building council houses, the Thatcher government forcing them to councils not to build. I mean, the lobby, I think, you know, it's a crying shame that there's even an attempt to get rid of David Miller, because he's absolutely one of the only people in the country who's really on the ball on criticising the lobby in a way, mainly the way it works through the media. His website Spinwatch has done an absolutely brilliant job in cataloguing all these so-called independent people that pop up on the TV that of course are paid by one lobby or other. At the moment it's mainly the pharmaceutical lobby. When we see things like people from John Hopkins University, Imperial College, you can almost guarantee that they're in the direct pay of Bill Gates, because Gates has got whole departments in both of these universities that their main job is to churn this stuff out, Martin.
Yeah, and it's not just the pharmaceutical industry, it's also the banking industry and the military industrial complex.
Well, one little thing, I just literally came across this as we were looking up the stuff to do with Uber. Didn't notice it whilst we were chatting with Saf just now, but this is about the personal relationship that David Cameron had with a woman called Rachel Whetstone, who was Uber's senior vice president of policy and communications. Well, that's a nice job if you can get it, to get Uber and be mates with the prime minister. But her husband was, guess who? Our old friend Steve Hilton, who was director of strategy for Cameron from 2010 to 2012. It's like a handful of people, Martin. This is almost feudal, isn't it, running the show?
That's right. And that Steve Hilton is different from the Steve Hilton on Fox News.
No, it's the same guy.
It's the same guy.
Yeah, so all the stuff that he's been revealing about Peter Daszak over in Wuhan and Dr. Fauci funding this gain-of-function research, which certainly to me, you know, looks like this is the main, like most likely cause of the release of the virus, most probably deliberate rather than accidental. Although he's exposing that over on Fox News, there he is doing. I mean, these people, to me, it's like rule by a clique. It's not democracy when you're ruling by a clique, is it?
No, it's not. And ultimately, if the system has been designed, it's not that the system is failing. The system is designed to work in this way. And the longer it works in this way, the more biased the system becomes. There was a period from the end of the Second World War until the 70s where the playing field was effectively leveled. But the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 90s led to a situation where the corporate interests in the West ripped up the previously existing social contract. So, for example, a basic thing, wages used to rise in line with productivity growth. And from 1979 onwards, wages have stagnated.
What we've got a situation now is wage slavery, where people are working very hard, but they haven't necessarily got the income to literally make ends meet, have they?
No, they haven't.
So that's wage slavery, isn't it?
Well, wage slavery is any wage slavery is anybody who works for a wage, but at least...
Well, not if they're making, you know, million pounds a year, or they give themselves a 12.5% pay rise.
Wages used to rise in line with productivity growth. And that meant that people, basically, their basic standard of living used to rise. There's a very interesting article in The Guardian last week. Wages in this country have stagnated for decades. At the same time, house prices have risen. So basically, you're giving money to property owners, free money, because, of course, house prices shouldn't really rise. In Germany, they don't. They basically stay stable. And that allows them to have a manufacturing-led economy where basically wages rise along with productivity and they sell their stuff into the world market. We specialise in conservatories and garden design, which, of course, you can't sell to foreign countries. I mean, basically, our system rewards...
Well, we do weapons too.
Weapons, yes.
High-tech weapons.
High-tech weaponry, yeah.
Which you can sell.
Well, yes, you can. But at the same time, ultimately, the buyers of that, like Saudi Arabia, that is not like making a better widget to improve the life of the ordinary person, is it? The Saudi regime doesn't represent the ordinary people of Saudi Arabia, but they spend the taxes raised in Saudi Arabia on our weaponry. But none of this is anything to do with the free market. Nothing at all.
Just one thing, I imagine has been, it may be British, it may not, but London City Airport has decided it doesn't need air traffic controllers to be on scene, that they're going to be sitting remotely somewhere watching the airport on a screen. Now, the first thing that makes me wonder, Martin, is, you know, this is all hackable, this stuff. Someone could just hack London City Airport, close the place down. What if you've got an aircraft that's flown, you know, near its limit there, and then they say, oh, sorry, air traffic control's broken down. At the very least, you know, you need backup visual contact with the airport, and you need backup radio communication with an aircraft in case your systems go down. But here they're saying, which is one of the most stupid and ridiculous things I've ever seen, that they're now not, they're not going to have any air traffic controls actually based at the airport itself. They won't be able to see anything. They'll just be sitting somewhere else, remotely guiding planes in. Now, this is normal for the, should we say, the big scale air traffic control. That's, for example, sending aircraft backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, but not when you're talking about movements of the aircraft on the airfield and landing and taking off. I mean, this seems absolutely unbelievable to me from a safety point of view, Martin. And also, they don't seem to have considered that this system could be hacked, which obviously it could.
Yes, I mean, all of these complex systems are vulnerable to failure. And the other thing that's underlying all of this is, as we robotize, effectively, that's what we're doing, you basically drive down the wages of the people who are in work, and you drive some people out of the economy altogether. And the problem with that is, who's going to buy the stuff that you produced? And the answer they come up with, well, we'll lend them the money to buy the stuff. And that's why we've now got the biggest debt bubble in history, which has grown exponentially since the 2008 crash. And house prices are rising in this country at the moment. This is all rigged to win the Tories' elections. They also decided that they were going to have this levelling up agenda, and that money has all gone to marginal Tory constituencies. None of it has gone to the really deprived parts of the country. So Liverpool was the most deprived. Knoll in Liverpool is the most deprived part of the country. They have had their money cut. Dorset, East Dorset, which is the richest part of the country, they have had their money increased. So those who hath shall be given, to those who hath nothing, even the little that they have shall be taken away.
It's
going to lead to a crash.
Why isn't Keir Starmer making more of a fuss about this? He's supposed to be a socialist.
He's trying to make a fuss about it, but you've got to remember that on certain things he's quite good at
he's making a fuss about the Prime Minister's flat, because that's what the Daily Mail's talking about.
The problem is that there's a fund. What happens is you get a kind of ratchet effect whereby, having privatised the housing stock, you've got a situation where some people have basically been bribed with other people's money to vote Tory. I am not a homeowner. I live in rented accommodation. I pay more for what I'm getting than if I was buying that.
How do we sort this housing crisis out there?
You need to build council houses. And you need to get prime land and build council houses. And you also need, what you could do with them, as was mentioned by your correspondent in Cheltenham, there's a million houses.
Chippenham.
Yeah. There's a million houses empty. You could requisition them.
Or you could just get people to build the houses they've already got planning permission for.
Well, in actual fact,
and I'm sorry, if you don't build that house within the next year, you lose
you
your
could,
permission.
You could have
the other thing you could do is
to stop this
land banking. You know what he was talking about there? He was saying, well, what they do is they get their planning permission, they put one trench across the land, and then they leave it for years and years. Well, you could say, well, sorry, your planning permission's lapsed.
That's right. You could do that. You could say, use it or lose it, but in actual fact, it's going in the opposite direction. This Tory government is loosening planning regulations to allow developers make more money. They give the money to the Tory party,
Martin,
to win elections on the first pass.
The rest of the economy is collapsing, and that they can't dare allow the housing market to collapse, because
no, they can't.
Then, as soon as the housing market goes, the rest of it is actually over a cliff.
Well, what you should be doing is spending money directly on the people who need it to so that you reflow the economy from the bottom.
It's a financial decision. It's not a human decision. And that's, to me, is the main problem, is that money is now being used against people rather than for people. It's not serving people. It's enslaving them.
Well, it was ever thus, but they are making it worse. And it's a deliberate policy.
Well, it wasn't thus, was it, in the 1970s? Stella Clark, who we spoke to on this programme several years ago now, she was very proud to say that, well, back in the 1970s, we'd built all the homes we needed and everyone had a house.
Yeah.
There was no homelessness and everyone had somewhere to live. And so she said, well, at that point, I thought I'd retire. But actually, no, she did carry on and she did quite a lot of building of homes for ex-servicemen, people like this. But, you know, that was the situation back in the 70s. Now it's completely the opposite. We've had this massive load of migrants as well, making a much, much bigger demand on the existing housing stock.
Well, the population has grown, that's for sure. And of course, that's what makes the economy grow as well.
Well, wasn't it 350,000 a year we were getting? More people coming into the country.
All right, well, the people not having no houses is not because of that. It's because we haven't got sufficient housing stock for low-income people.
I think that there's been an attempt to use the situation of more people than there are houses in order to just ratchet the market up.
That's right.
Anyway, I think there's a lot of... It'd be lovely to see if the TV people really looked into this. Is that guy on Channel 4 that sometimes does look at the housing market? And we've had all sorts of awful stories. I was in Blenafan last week. My God, that place is just collapsing. There's no work. I think the only thing that kept it going was UNESCO grants, Martin, to build museums and things. And
where
now
is
there's
it?
Blenafan in South Wales, right. You know, right, an ex-industrial area. And there's just nothing to people to do there. There's only about something like one in five, maybe even one in eight of the shops still open. The rest are all boarded up. And loads of youngsters sitting around on the street with nothing to do.
Well, that's the result of the policies pursued in the 1980s, which were quite deliberately to get rid of Britain's industrial base, privatise the housing stock, and of course, that was massively successful for the top 5% of the population, who are very, very much wealthier than they were at that stage.
Yeah, we heard Manfred Petrisch saying the same about Germany. They're worried that even German industry is going to be going. But anyway, lots and lots of crookedness and backhanders and brown envelopes going around. But this, we're going to finish part one by having a little listen back to last week. Or this is this week's last of the three episodes of Bent Coppers, one of the best series I've seen, documentary series on the TV for the last few years. And I'm not just saying that because it includes my friend Martin Short, who I think was one of the greatest journalists. He was part of the old school journalism. You hear him a bit in this clip, who were around at the time I started in journalism. And I looked up to people like him, but there's not many left like that. Most of them these days seem to be just, and I don't blame them for this, just trying to keep their job. They know if they speak out like people like I do, that they'll probably be out the window tomorrow. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip from the final episode on BBC Two last Wednesday evening of Bent Coppers crossing the line of duty.
The robbers clearly planned the raid meticulously. They'd got at least three getaway vehicles and they used a truck to seal one escape route.
Two men ran out of the bank and he fired after them and they shot back at him and he got shot in the arm.
Certain robberies were occurring within a very small area, the City of London. People were getting arrested, but they were getting bail and the evidence against them appeared to be being watered down. Rumours began to circulate that deals of some sort had been done. The attention switched from Scotland Yard over to the City of London CID, and that the firm in a firm had not been put out of business and Bent Cops were still rampant.
At the dawn of the 1970s, London was a city under threat.
Vice and sex has taken over. Anybody?
The officers would bring whatever was seized to me, and I would report it, where it was found, how it was found, who it was found by, and it would go in my book.
Now,
Your exhibit officer would, by that at that time, have prepared a clean place to work, and it would be packed in what?
A brown paper bag.
Right.
The investigation was effectively run by Detective Chief Inspector Phil Cuthbert. Phil Cuthbert was the divisional CID head. Confident, very popular with his men, great personality, good company. On one occasion, I was walking down to the exhibit store from the seventh floor when I was followed out of the incident room by Phil Cuthbert. He was above me and he said, "Lou, I've got a drink for you." And he handed me some notes and it was £50. Which I took, put it in my pocket. I don't think I said anything. It was expected of me to accept it. It was part of the culture and I should be grateful for it. I never considered giving it back.
People would tell me stories about taking a drink, and a drink was a brown envelope.
A young CID officer, wet behind the ears, would in due course have to be baptised in the way of the world. If there'd been a good day and you got a few nickings, somebody would come in and start distributing envelopes. Sticking it in your top pocket or putting it in your desk drawer. Suddenly, you had become corrupt.
A couple of weeks later, Phil Cuthbert followed me out again and said, "Lou, I've got a drink for you," and then handed me another £50. In my view, if I'd have had what Phil Cuthbert referred to as a drink, then it's ridiculous to think that people at a higher rank than me didn't have a drink as well. And the higher you went, the bigger drink they got.
In the 7 weeks after the Williams and Glynn's raid, a number of suspects are identified.
First I know about the William and Glynn's bank robbery was I received a teleprinter message from the City of London to the Flying Squad office asking for information on the whereabouts of two particular robbers who they believe were involved in it.
Told me £300 the other day. 20 grand they had.
20 grand?
Well, why £300 the other day?
That's what one officer got.
Who got 300?
It doesn't matter. I'm not going to grass.
Cuthbert is essentially saying that the robbers in that robbery handed over to the police so that they wouldn't be prosecuted £20,000, which was a lot of money in its day. More than £100,000 now.
What a beautiful series. Beautifully shot, lovely music, beautifully crafted bit of television. Very, very rare sort of thing to see nowadays. The only reason that they can do this and talk about this, Martin, because the people they're talking about almost, well, they are, they're dead now. What we've got is surviving junior officers chatting on screen about the extent of corruption. One of the most interesting things in the final series was the, at least in my view, was the fact that, all the CID officers in the City of London and the Met were all called in to a briefing on from one of the senior commanders on scenes of crime evidence. Now, this is a very basic thing. And the chap that's on the documentary was talking about, he's saying, well, you know, we wonder what's going on here. We know all about scenes of crime. We know what to do. We've done this back and front at police college and all sorts. And it turned out that they'd all been called in because there was an armed robbery taking place and they didn't want the police out on the streets.
Yeah, it's all shocking stuff, isn't it? I mean, I used to live in South London when Stephen Lawrence was murdered, and it was pretty clear to most people in South London what had happened there, which was that the criminal gang who killed him, their father was one of the biggest drug dealers in South London, and he had police on the on the payroll. So that's why his boys thought that they could get away with killing
Daniel Morgan.
Because they were going to be protected.
Well, there was a lot of protection for people who were involved in that. Now, they talk about it on there, saying, well, actually, this drink, so it's £300 for a more senior officer, £50 for a detective constable, that money is there so that if anyone asks them to testify, they know they're not going to testify. So that would be another police officer asking them on the outside chance of that. That's 20 grand from a actual armed robbery goes straight to the police. This is, this is the way that I suppose that the armed robbers realise that they could just get away with it. What do you make of the extent of the... It finishes off the show, the final episode, by saying that this is an ongoing problem and that police corruption has not by any means disappeared.
Well, I think anybody who knows anything about law enforcement knows that these things are part, go with the territory. The illegal drugs industry creates huge profit margins for those involved in it and corrupts whole countries like Mexico and Colombia, where the political leadership is entirely in the pocket of the drug cartels who are working closely with the CIA.
What about things like Operation Countryman? I mean, that was one of the things they talked about. So they had various things they looked at in the different programs. The second one was about the Vice Squad. The final one was about the Flying Squad and all the corruption going on in both of those. The idea really is that if you're paying somebody off, and one of the people says this, I'm getting my £50 drink to be bribed not to talk about this, but he realised that there was actually a Securicorps guard shot dead in that raid. That's blood money.
Well, it certainly is, but of course it goes with the territory. If you're going to be dealing with organised criminals, then they've got big resources. And they're going to deploy their resources. The obvious thing to do is to corrupt the police force. That's what they try to do.
There is always these groups that are supposed to oversee the police, and every 10 years they change the name of it because it's been so useless, it's been discredited.
Well, I was talking to somebody about what goes on in South Africa, and they had an elite anti-corruption squad called the Scorpions. But of course, the Scorpions themselves were corrupted, and then you've got to set up another squad to invest the Scorpions, and then they were corrupted, and you've got an even more high-level squad investing the second-level squad, which is investing the first-level squad, which is supposedly the elite anti-corruption
squad. Well, we had Operation Countryman, but Robert Mark also put the fear of God into these people because he made them realise that they may well be doing time for it. In fact, there were a whole load of officers who were arrested and did go to jail. It goes into all of that, and in fact, one of the officers who turned Queen's evidence. But at the moment, Martin, there doesn't seem to be any real impetus to do anything about this whatsoever. I just wondered maybe, with one of these police and crime commissioners, maybe they could potentially make a bit of difference. But there's certainly not been any impetus to, run anything like Sir Robert Mark was. I think I might be right in saying, maybe you can remember, whether Rowan Bosworth Davis said he was part of that in the 1970s and 1980s, where they tried to bring in a whole new load of officers spending most of the time investigating Scotland Yard itself.
Well, that's right. And of course,
Fraud Squad.
Rowan Bosworth Davis was in the Fraud Squad, and he resigned after the Blue Arrow trial, where the lead people in the city were basically let go, even though they'd been involved in financial fraud. And the banking system depends fundamentally on the drugs industry. And of course, that's when the banks crashed in 2008. There's a study done by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And at that point, the banks, individual banks, were all desperate for cash. And the drug cartel said, well, you need cash. We need it laundered. And they just laundered it through the system.
Okay, so I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the BBC series Before It Disappears. Well worth a watch. Bent coppers crossing the line of duty with, bless him, Martin Short, who's also the author of Inside the Brotherhood. They actually get into the Freemasons a little bit in the final episode, explaining that the Masonic Lodge was the obvious place to get these things sorted out. And of course, it wasn't that they were sorting the corrupt police officers out. It was that they were making sure that they knew who the non-corrupt police officers were who might be trying to sort them out. And that's what was being done in the Masonic lodges. So, interesting. And another report, Operation Riverside, I think, that came out about 10 years ago, which proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that Masonic influences were being used within all sorts of public services, particularly the police, though, in London, in order to commit crime and to protect those who were committing crime in the firm, within a firm. But anyway, we haven't talked about coronavirus yet, believe it or not, or COVID-19, but we will certainly be doing that because there was a big march last Saturday in London, some people saying up to 500,000 people marching in London, after we've had a little bit of music. And that is, I think, beginning with a song, I suppose, it's the sort of song that could have been written by politicians.
To get wet.
Quite sure what the dogs are in the background there. Maybe that's part of the music video for that. But that was Electronica, Getting Away With It in 1990, and followed by Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson, Say Say Say, in 1983. So just one final, I know this is a really naughty thing to do, Martin, but on the mayor and the mayoral election, we've got these three or four, depending on the way you look at it, elections going on next Thursday for individual councillors, 70 of which are right across the city for different wards, most of which don't have a lot of power because we've got a mayor system. So people that want to get rid of that would be voting for the Lib Dem Caroline Gooch, who's pledged to get rid of it straight away, as soon as she gets elected, to get rid of her own job. So we've then also got the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, where we had an interview with Anthony Stansfield recently, pledging to take seriously the allegations by Avon and Somerset Police, which Avon and Somerset Police don't want to pursue, against the four victims of Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit on Castle Park. So the super rich actually may be having their collars felt by Avon and Somerset. That would be nice. And finally, the Metro Mayor, which is a really mysterious idea, dreamt up by Business West and John Savage, a Labour Party member who left when Jeremy Corbyn became Labour leader, in order to have a mayor which was a Tory mayor, because the wider constituency area means it's almost certain to be a Conservative that wins it, with all the sort of 20-30 miles outside Bristol all voting for it around the edge as well. It's unlikely to be a Labour person winning it. Anyway, we shall see what happens. We'll obviously be looking at all those results from those elections next week. But Martin, we've had a bit of a whoopsie from the Mayor Marvin Rees again. Here he is, apparently saying that he has been endorsed by somebody from the watershed. Now, a bit of a problem, because the watershed has immediately had to distance itself from Marvin Rees's election campaign after a post from his official Twitter account prompted complaints that showed support which would be illegal. Charities are banned from endorsing or funding political candidates, including Mr. Rees, who's standing to be elected as Bristol Mayor against eight other hopefuls next Thursday. A tweet from his account on Wednesday morning, April 28th, which has since been deleted, including a quote from Dick Penny, who's chief executive of the city's flagship arts venue from 1998 to 2018, backing the Labour incumbent as inspiring and showing extraordinary city leadership. Beneath Mr. Penny's photo was his name and the name and the word watershed. A spokesman for Mr. Rees's campaign says all endorsements are in a personal capacity, but the post sparked complaints on Twitter that it was in breach of charity law and charity commission guidance. So Is Dick Penny representing Watershed, or is he representing himself? Anyway, the tweets have all now disappeared, and I think there's the PR machine has rather shot itself in the foot there. So anyway, that's the last on our local stuff. What about the bigger stuff, though, Martin? Because the main news this week is that Joe Biden is now, it looks like, getting to the point of maybe rolling back these Iran sanctions, which is just terrific news. I don't think it will go down well, though, in Tel Aviv.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, to be honest. There's still a lot of doubt about whether any of this is going to come to pass. There's a presidential election coming up in Iran. It's likely to be a hardliner that wins it. And it may well be that the...
Well, can I just quote? You say you don't think it. It's Associated Press saying the Biden administration is considering a near wholesale rollback of the stringent Trump-era sanctions on Iran.
Yes, but they've also said that the Iranians have first of all got to come into compliance, and then they will consider rolling back the sanctions. Yeah, and the Iranians have already said, "Well, we're not doing that. You come back into the agreement, and then we will discuss what we're going to do. But you've got to move first."
Okay. So, what's happening in this news story from Associated Press is the Americans are moving. They're saying they are becoming increasingly expansive about what they might be prepared to offer Iran. So they're changing
But I mean, I suspect a bit of spin involved here. What they're trying to do is make it look as if the Iranians are being the awkward ones, when in actual fact, it's quite straightforward. The United States has already signed up to this agreement. They just have to say, right, we're going back to where we were before Trump came along. And if they present an agreement to the Iranians, which the Iranians don't find acceptable, which they might not, they're then going to say, oh, it's the Iranians who aren't being reasonable.
Even the Iranians are saying there's been a change of tone.
Well, the Iranians, it's in the Iranians' interest to try and negotiate with them if they can. But I suspect that they may still, I mean, certainly the Israelis will not be keen on that, and they will doing everything they can behind the scenes to sabotage it.
At the same time, an Israeli minister is saying our warplanes can reach Iran. Well, we knew that. I don't know if we knew whether they'd be shot down or not. The threat comes as the US and Iran are negotiating a revival of the JCPOA, which Israel is so strongly opposed to. He stepped up the threatening rhetoric, an Israeli cabinet minister, warning that a US return to the nuclear deal would mean war. That's pretty strong.
Yeah, it is. In other words, even if Biden was minded...
How can the Israelis say that from whatever it is, 7,000 miles away, 8,000 miles away? They're dictating US policy. They're saying, well, if you want to return to this nuclear deal, we're going to start a war.
Well, that's because they've basically got their hooks into the US government at every level.
And surely the Americans would just, if they are really a superpower, they would just say, well, tough. We're going to do what we want.
As Netanyahu said years ago to a sympathetic audience, and it was recorded, nothing to worry about with the Americans. They just do as we tell them. And that is largely the case. Trump did everything they wanted. Did he?
I mean, he may have done some things, but would he do everything the Israeli wanted?
Well, he certainly moved the... capital of Jerusalem to capital of Israel to Jerusalem, and Biden's done nothing to reverse that. So the signals are pretty clear there's a bipartisan hostility to Iran, hostility to Russia, hostility to China, and of course there's lots of squabbling at the top in the US about which of these three countries they're going to be most hostile to. But there's no consideration of, you know, somebody serious will be talking about what do we need to do to do deals with all these people who don't agree with us.
Well, also the White House is saying that the Afghan withdrawal has begun. Hooray! Only trouble is those troops, it looks like, might be deployed to threaten China.
Yeah, and in any case, what will happen there is that the private military military companies will simply take over.
Well,
there's already tens of thousands.
It's the privatisation of the war, isn't it? Yeah. But I mean, was Afghanistan, do you think, ever really threatening the Chinese and, you know, the Silk Road and their trade initiatives that they want?
Well, Afghanistan, because of its geography, is right in the middle of, you know, potential commercial routes, as it was back in history. And therefore, by destabilizing Afghanistan, they make it very difficult for Pakistan and China, for example, to develop, and they've got a strong relationship, but, you know, Afghanistan in chaos prevents that being coming to fruition in a way which is constructive for people in that region. And the US is basically playing a game of spoilers. That's what the whole war in Syria is about. It's just, you know, if we can't have it, you're not going to get it. And, you know, they're basically, they're pretty explicit about it. They want to be the universal world hegemon, and everybody has got to fit in with what they want. And, of course, they themselves are also being told what to do by the Israelis. So, you know, the situation is actually very dangerous, because the Iranians, the Russians and the Chinese don't have much to hope for from this new administration, and they are preparing to fight.
Well, obviously China is the main target for the United States, as they fail to be able to compete with them on a level playing field in trade, because they're literally just uncompetitive. Main reason seems to me to be that there's massive overheads to pay in the United States, because, like here in Britain, enormous property prices, privatised utility prices for gas, water, electricity, transport, all those rackets that are running over in the West make it impossible for the West to compete with China anymore. But we've got a solution. It's war. As usual, tanks and think tanks, how Taiwanese cash is funding the push to war with China, the Mint Press News are saying this week, Martin. 20 years ago, a group of neoconservative think tanks used their power to push for disastrous wars in the Middle East. Now, a new set of think tanks, staffed with many of the same experts, funded by Taiwanese money, is working hard to convince Americans that there is a new existential threat, China.
Yeah. And, you know, we had David Miller talking about Spinwatch earlier, and the military-industrial complex in the West and the banking system and all the rest of it, they need an enemy. You know, in the real world, it should be perfectly feasible for a market-oriented China and a democratic Russia and a democratic Iran, because they do have elections in Iran, unlike in Saudi Arabia, to cooperate to solve the various problems that the world faces. But that would require the US to just be another normal country with its interests, which would have to be balanced off against other people's interests. And they've got absolutely hooked to the idea that they are the only people who matter, and that everybody else has just got to get into line or they're going to jump all over them.
What do you think there's actually going to be some sort of conflict with the Chinese? Because, I mean, surely...
Well, it's already there. I mean, the question is, when people say, is there a conflict, it's already there on various levels. And it's, you know, a lot of it is mudslinging. Some of it is espionage and sabotage, and some of it is shooting. I mean, there's several wars been started in the last 10 years in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, and it's just ongoing, isn't it? The South China Sea, our aircraft carrier with borrowed F-35s on it is steaming into the South China Sea as we speak, and then we wonder why we've got no money for special needs children in our schools, because we've apparently got enough money to send an aircraft carrier, which has actually no military significance at all. If the shooting starts, it will be sunk, but we're doing what the Americans want, and that's what they've told us to do, and then we're doing it. Because we're a colony.
Okay, NATO in Mali, Martin, with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Socialist Bloc, it led the world witness what some termed the unipolar moment, and others the end of history. Well, we were promised a peace dividend, weren't we? No entity benefited more from the opening up of the world than the Pentagon. It immediately insinuated itself into every corner and cranny of the world, bringing every nation in Europe and the former Soviet republics in Central Asia into an alliance with NATO. Something called the Partnership for Peace, training military personnel from several scores of countries in their respective homelands at sites in the US. This led to what would never have been previously imaginable, regular US-led multinational military exercises in countries like Cambodia, Kazakhstan, Mongolia. It also resulted in the Pentagon developing direct military-to-military ties with all of Africa's 54 nations, with the exception of Eritrea and Zimbabwe. In the 1990s, the US began training the armed forces of Mali in the Sahel. In the early years of the century, Washington was actively involved in a counterinsurgency war in the north of the country against the Tuaregs. By 2005, they set up an operational base at an airfield in the capital in Bamako. I mean, this is just a terrific article. It just shows how this stuff begins small with the end of the Cold War. And rather than a peace dividend, as they were talking through their lying lips about a peace dividend, they were sending their people in to make sure that war was going to be coming out of it from the Pentagon. They've got these various command centres, haven't they, Martin, around the world, some of which are in Stuttgart in Germany, as we were hearing from Manfred Petrisch last week. And the United States does seem to think that it wants to dominate the world through its what they call unified command structure.
That's right. And of course, the destruction of Libya then had very deleterious consequences for West Africa. And the French in particular participated in that because they wanted to destroy Gaddafi's attempt to set up an alternative currency system Africa.
It seems like they're obviously not going to succeed in this. It should have been obvious to the Pentagon that there's enough resistance around the world to this, that they're not going to take over the world. They're not going to have their military controlling every country, even though they've got a lot of people dedicated to trying to do that. They're basically banging their head against a brick wall.
Yes, and you'd have thought that if you're doing that, they might stop and take a step back and think about what could we do that would be more constructive. But the military-industrial complex doesn't necessarily have to win in order to make money. Yeah, so that they're not actually making necessarily rational military decisions. They're taking irrational decisions from a military point of view. Look at all the grand old Duke of York stuff about what happened in Ukraine. Most people in the West think that the Russians were threatening Ukraine. That's not the case. The Ukrainians threatened to attack the breakaway republics. And at that point, the Russians responded to the threat, and they brought lots of kit up to the front line to make the point. And eventually, of course, by the Russians having their manoeuvres, NATO was forced to confront the fact, as Scott Ritter pointed out on this show some weeks ago, that if there's any fight in that region, NATO will simply be pulverised. They won't win. They've got no chance of winning. And that's good, because that means that they, not because they're good people, they've got the realistic understanding that if they get it wrong, they're going to lose. And losing means that they may lose everything, because the whole US empire may implode, especially if the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency. And that's a definite possibility. Lots of people are working, you know, the Chinese, the Russians and others are working to dethrone the dollar. And at that point, the US then has to pay its own bills rather than allowing everybody else to pay their bills, because they've got a tribute system effectively. You know, places like Argentina and West Africa fund the US military, and then the military is used to keep these people down. But ultimately, of course, it may just crash and burn. It should just crash and burn. Let's hope that not many people die in the conflagration.
Well, there's all this everything going on in the background, which is the COVID operation, as I would call it, which is this idea of destroying civil liberties around the world based on the idea of a virus, which is possibly, most probably, man-made and released deliberately. Quite why the timing at the time, who only knows, but must be certainly scheduled to coincide the other way around. Maybe, you know, that the Great Reset came out as a result of COVID, who knows, but roughly the two things seem to be working hand in hand. The idea to reset the world's economy, which is Klaus Schwab, the former, he was into the nuclear industry in Germany before World War II, his family, and people like Prince Charles, as well, getting very much involved in this, who may be going to be soon take over as head of state, may be going on for a more international role, who knows. But Martin, we've got lots going on. One of the things this week is all to do, I mean, we've been covering over the years stuff to do with designer babies in United States and here particularly. Scientists successfully create an embryo from both human and monkey cells, so that's great. You've got an embryo now, which is part monkey, part human.
Well, this technology is coming ahead by leaps and bounds, And, you know, the possibilities of misuse are clearly there, aren't they?
It's a good site, I think. It's lifesitenews.com. I think, a Catholic site. But they're saying, in an alarming new development in biological experimentation, scientists have created a what they call a hybrid embryo composed of human and monkey cells. This is the 23rd of April, so this time last week. Interspecies chimera formation with human pluripotent stem cells represents a necessary alternative to evaluate pluripotency in vivo and might constitute a promising strategy, some spokesperson says in the article. But this is, we're really getting towards the stage here, which I see this as a part of the transhumanist agenda, with these people that have decided, well, you know, we are gods basically, and the rich and powerful can do what they want, and they can engineer humanity, including mixing bits of humans with bits of monkeys, in order to create what they see as a more perfect version of the human race. Now, there's very little real checks and balances on this. There are some, but Martin, this just seems like it's who is funding this? Why? Where's the money coming from? That's the sort of thing I'd like to know. And is there going to be any limits to what these genetic engineers will play around with, human embryos and human cells, or animal cells as well?
Well, a lot of it's funded by the military, which is why both the Chinese and the Russians in recent weeks have been pointing their finger at these biological warfare labs, which have been set up in Ukraine and Georgia, in particular in Europe, and also in close proximity to China. And the basic seed corn funding for this kind of stuff is military. It's DARPA, you know, what's a... Dominic Cummings's favourite organisation. And then, of course, there's a profits to be made by private corporations on the back of that. So you then get a vicious circle of military expenditure, bringing in making private profit. And, of course, you've got to ask yourself, well, what rational goal is there here? What are they doing to make life better for ordinary people? And the answer is not a lot.
It could even be nothing, actually. Yes, nothing at all.
It could even be against their interests
exactly,
altogether.
Exactly, like the gain-of-function research. Absolutely right. Anyway, so just talking about Prince Charles there, a little item in the Bristol Post, which passed me by last week. Actually, this week, maybe it was Monday, Prince Charles's plan to shrink the size of the royal family could see key members ditch. Now, this strikes me as very much, it's the same sort of thing that we've seen restructuring of democracy here in the city with these partnership agreements with business. Is West and this kind of thing. The idea is, you, this is the way I want it, I'm in charge, so I'm going to do it. So Prince Charles wants to restructure the monarchy and get rid of most of them.
Well, I mean, there are quite a lot of
people. That means there won't be anyone competing with him, doesn't it?
Well, indeed, and in actual fact, why many, many members of the royal family, I think there's several hundred of them on the civil list, most of them don't do anything. So you could argue that that's not necessarily a bad idea.
Well, I mean,
but you might conclude that you've got to get rid of them altogether. Why spend any money on them?
Yeah, well, he doesn't want them. I mean, he's got plenty of money, hasn't he, as the Duke of Cornwall. He's getting massive amounts of rent in.
Yes, well, the Duke of Cornwall, you could argue that is actually the state, and therefore he shouldn't have it. And that basically they can go off and be private citizens, but things like the Duke of Cornwall are basically not private. They are the state, the British state, and therefore the resources that they generate should go into the exchequer.
Well, so he was talking to Talk Radio. The royal biographer Angela Levin said that Prince Charles is likely to press on with the long-held plans, despite the Queen wanting to keep the royal family together and avoid change. So it does seem like there's a completely different vision for where the royal family is going from these two. And it doesn't surprise me that someone who's about to come into one of the greatest to inherit the greatest wealth on the planet, which is a fantastic amount of property that the Queen owns in central London, etc., and elsewhere. And some would say, as Kevin Cahill would say, that the freehold on a lot of land in Canada, Australia, and places like that as well. So he's saying, well, I want to be in 100% charge. I don't like the idea of sharing this with anybody.
Yes.
That may not go down too well, might it?
No, but I mean, I think the bigger picture is things like you said. Well, why would they release this virus at this time? The banking system collapsed in September 2019. It was exactly the same as the collapse in 2008, apart from the fact that they'd already set up mechanisms to bail the banks out. In 2008, they had to go cap in hand to Congress and to various governments around the world to set up bailout facilities. But in 2019, they'd already got a to-go plan, which nobody was even aware of, who was outside the inner circle. And BlackRock, which is a private equity fund, has basically taken over both the US Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And that has just happened just like that in a blink of an eye. Now, if there had been no COVID, we'd all be saying, what the hell happened there?
Well, we might. But what COVID did is
led to a situation where everybody thinks that what's happening is to do with COVID, whereas in actual fact, it's not to do with COVID.
Yeah, but I mean, on the COVID front, since we're going there now, it may simply be that nobody has properly looked at the chance of use of having antivirals like chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, which seems to be more effective. And I was wondering actually the other day about our sound engineer Dave, who was talking about his friend in the States who had a little pill that killed off her flu, a sort of magic pill of some sort. And it was, where did you get that from? Wow, that was incredible. I don't have any flu anymore. That was something very similar to ivermectin, particularly because one of my friends told me face-to-face, told me that he had had the initial stages of COVID. Like, literally, it started to, he started to get a very, shortness of breath. You know what it's like when you get a cold? You suddenly think, oh God, I've got a cold. I think I have anyway. Anyway, so he took just one tablet of chloroquine, which he had because he travels abroad. It's an anti-malarial drug that he takes when he goes abroad. Usually you take it for a few days, I think, before you leave, and then a few days after you come back. He took one of those pills and then the symptoms would disappear within half an hour, completely gone, and never came back. So that was just at the very, very start of it. So these antivirals, quite clearly, are a very, very important way to treat it. And I was rather annoyed this week with certain Mr. Zuckerberg on Facebook, because I posted what I thought was a very responsible post saying, look, if you're going to take ivermectin as a complementary medicine as regards, or even prophylactically, in other words, so, you know, you've got it in your system the whole time in case you catch it, ivermectin is very safe, and that this is the dose you should take, which, by the way, is six in the morning, six in the evening, that's 12 altogether in a 24-hour period, just to make sure that you've got the right amount inside you. And Facebook said, well, that's no good, you can't say that, you can't do that, we're banning you, you could kill people by saying that. And so a bit like BCFM's manager Pat Hart saying we should go off the airwaves because us criticising, you know, the government for taking the elderly people out of hospitals and sticking them straight into care homes with loads of other elderly people was a bad idea. You know, obviously, you know, you do need some robust journalism in order to save people's lives and to criticise the government in situations like this, and particularly when the government is just doing what the big pharmaceutical industries want to anyway. But anyway, what convinced them, it seems, I sent them in this article from Nature magazine about ivermectin, which is a recent article, and the article concludes, we show antiviral effects of ivermectin on a broad range of RNA and DNA viruses by reviewing all related evidence since 1970, right? It goes back a long way, this. This study presents the possibility that ivermectin could be a useful antiviral agent in several viruses, including those with positive sense single-stranded RNA in similar factions, since significant effectiveness of ivermectin is seen in the early stages of infection in these experimental studies. It's proposed that ivermectin administration may be effective in the early stages of prevention. Of course, confirmation of this statement requires human studies and more clinical trials. So there it is in black and white. It's saying that this is definitely an effective treatment, although the FLCCC say they've already done as many trials as they need to. Here is the official journal in the States, Nature, saying here it is. This is a potential, and what they call it is a complementary regime. So ivermectin could be a bit of a wonder drug. Martin, why weren't we using this from the start?
Well, as you know, there are vested interests in the pharmaceutical industry that don't want cheap alternatives to what they're offering. And Pfizer, for example, are definitely plugging their vaccine as a massive money-making exercise. There's no doubt about that. And, of course, you know, they have more ways and means of squeezing out stuff which they don't want to use. I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion, but I know what, you know, the economics of it are that they want to basically make monopoly profits in a disaster capitalist scenario.
Well, Frontline Critical Care Alliance, which are one of the people, it's www.covid19criticalcare.com, are saying now that the Critical Care Alliance have made a statement on new guidance for ivermectin from the All India Institute of Medical Science. I mean, they're putting stuff out all the time. They're doing a weekly podcast update as well about ivermectin. They're just completely obsessed with this stuff, and quite rightly, because they reckon that up to 90% of people that contract this could potentially be saved by this antiviral treatment, which has been around for years, perfectly safe, etc. And so there's all sorts of campaigning going on this, Martin, and other sorts of matters. But I thought we'd just take a side look at all this, and particularly because we've had the, I think it was Piers Corbyn this week, speaking at the SpyCops inquiry about how he was, as a climate change campaigner, was spied on, and his views on it all. And so he's part of the SpyCops inquiry, and he was interviewed this week as part of the inquiry. So, but the SpyCops thing hasn't really gone away, has it? Because we're continuing really to spy on campaign groups. The police are still unaccountable. There's still no proper checks on their, whether or not they're corrupt. And as we were hearing from the BBC Two documentary earlier from the 1980s and 70s. Anyway, this article's in the Canary. It says a leaked briefing provides a snapshot of a new police unit that's spying on protesters. An internal police briefing leaked online provides a snapshot into the workings of this new intelligence unit. The role of this unit is to spy on protesters across the UK. It's a division of the National Police Coordination Centre, NPOCC, and its work appears to be very similar to that of the earlier unit, the shamed officers of which were duly dubbed the Spy Cops. It says that it's a NPOCC, Strategic Intelligence and Briefing, and it prefaces that this report is solely for the use of approved named individuals on the audited distribution list. But the good old Canary have got a hold of a copy of it, Martin. Now, obviously, they are, it seems from this anyway, just to pricey it, most definitely targeting Black Lives Matter and other units, another protest group. So that means all of them, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, and of course, the special demonstration squad was actually being directed by MI5, so it wasn't just the Metropolitan Police doing this stuff off their own bat. It was the intelligence services who were directing them. And I think we're only getting what you might call the tip of the iceberg at this inquiry. And of course, it's going to run on for years. They're not going to be finished anytime soon. But I think you can pretty much presume that the deep state in this country infiltrates particularly progressive movements in order to sabotage them and
it's interesting
them.
You say MI5, because the Canary has also found that one of the best ways to get information on this new Spy Cops unit is through the job ads they put out. And of course, you know, this is a similar sort of thing with MI5, maybe probably 20 years ago first started putting these formal job adverts out there, because they can't get the people, I suppose, from within the usual tapping up process at universities.
Yeah, well, when I went to Oxford University in the late 70s, we worked out who was the MI5 recruiter. It was actually Professor Henry Stoy at Magdalen College, and he would basically prospect, you know, likely potential MI5 people, and they would be given a tap on the shoulder and told to meet the Whitehall visitor, who used to come down every term to interview people, but it was all completely secret. They didn't advertise anything in public. And then eventually, of course, after the Spycatcher scandal, they decided that they were going to change their attitude, and they now advertise openly for people to be spies. you know, in principle, you know, most countries have got an intelligence service and a police force. But of course, what's going on behind the scenes is not just that the first past the post system is rigged to keep the Tories in power, is that any political movements which threaten their hegemony are being, at taxpayer expense, sabotaged and undermined.
Well, I mean, as the Stasi hacking people's lives, having kids with people who hadn't even broken the law, was exposed and embarrassed. So this new law came out, Martin. It's called the Covert Human Intelligence Sources and Criminal Conduct Act, and it's now in law.
Indeed, and it was passed by the Tories on an 80-seat majority, and the Labour Party abstaining.
Yeah,
but of course all the other opposition parties, who would have much more power if there was not an FTPF system, they all voted against. And of course, why would they want to pass these laws which put the intelligence services, the police and the military above the law? And that's because they break the law all the time, and they're just closing that loophole so they can carry on breaking the law without any comeback.
And it's also because
that is basically tyrannous.
Well, they're busy creating a dictatorship, aren't they?
They are. And of course, all of this false flag terrorism they've been running for years, at some point, when we go to war with Russia and China, the dictatorship will reveal itself. And it's all basically been planned for years, and ultimately there's going to be a showdown about it. But at the same time, they're not necessarily going to get it all their own way, because, you know, they're overreaching themselves in so many ways, and they've not won in Syria, they've not been able to stabilize Iraq. If they start fighting in the South China Sea, they'll definitely lose. They've not been able to start a war in the Ukraine because the Russians are too strong for them. And ultimately, of course, the dollar is going to be dethroned as the world's reserve currency.
And in the meantime, there's a massive protest movement growing here in the UK. They seem to be going for monthly major marches on Saturdays through the summer in London, which is organised by a whole coalition of about 10 different groups who form a sort of anti-lockdown alliance. And last weekend, we had various estimates up and down, but certainly between 100,000 and 500,000 people marching through London. I know it took one person showed that it was a massive wide road full of people marching through. It took something like 30, 45 minutes for everybody to go past. And so there's it's very difficult to estimate these numbers. And it was very, very little coverage as well on the news, funnily enough, because people don't want you to know it's happening. And I think particularly with the broadcasters in a big city like London, if you see it happening, you think, well, I might go down, actually. Let's go down and see this. And that's one of the reasons they don't like having it on the news. But anyway, we're going to be talking to a couple of people who were there last Saturday. And we'll start, I think, with Phil Zimmerman, who's a former actor. He's still an actor now. But here is his description of what he saw last Saturday in central London.
The police were there's a very minimal police presence, and their body language was not in any way aggressive. They were just letting it happen. They were there on duty doing their job, like the police should be doing, on hand in case they needed, you know. So no problems, great atmosphere, music, people singing, brilliant banners, just a great, vibrant, you know, expression. And the next one is on May the 15th. So I really encourage anyone that hasn't been yet and wants to come not to be afraid. There is no outdoor transmission of the virus, as far as we can tell. The government SAGE advisor said that there was no transmission from the massive crowds that were packed onto beaches last summer. And with this whole movement, you know, as I say, you know, I don't know anyone. We all meet up every time. No mass die-offs from it. So it's a great day out.
Okay, the 15th, apparently the next one. But then I think so that's kind of, 2 weeks' time from now, pretty much, the next big one. But then they're also planning, Martin, various demonstrations in between times. That's the weekend after, in major cities around, including Bristol. But the main point here is, with this last demonstration, if you look at the signs, etc., there's a lot of people who were the Kill the Bill people in central London. There was no Kill the Bill demo last Saturday, so a whole load of Kill the Bill people thought, well, let's come and join these anti-lockdown. And although you could probably say more of them were wearing masks, the Kill the Bill types, they were actually getting on fine.
Well, I mean, there's going to be different views about all these different things, aren't there? Some people are opposed to the police and crime bill, and they're also anti-lockdown. Some people are opposed to the police and crime bill who are in favour of lockdowns, so and vice versa. So, you know, no, you shouldn't presume that anybody's position on anything is fixed. You know, there's all sorts of different.
Well, we
views,
shall certainly see next Thursday how well the opposition does, because there's been all sorts of accusations about the opposition, the Labour opposition, not actually opposing a lot of what the government's been doing anywhere near enough, and not least of which is the landlord of the Raven Pub in Bath last week having a rant and effectively throwing the Labour opposition leader Keir Starmer out of his pub. But anyway, someone else who was there last Saturday is a woman who's been on this show a few times. In fact, she was one of our first interviewees when the whole outbreak of SARS-CoV-2 started when I was over in New Zealand, and that's Judith Brown, and she was there last Saturday too.
It was a lovely day. I mean, we had fantastic weather, and that probably helped with the large number of people that came out onto the streets that day. And people of all ages, of all different ethnic backgrounds. It was really heartening to see it. And I haven't seen such a big demonstration since the Iraq War, but I've got a painful knee at the moment, and I had to keep stopping to rest. In fact, three times I rested between 20 and 30 minutes, expecting that I'd, each time I thought, well, when the tail end of the demonstration passes, I'll join on the tail end. But in fact, at the end of it, I was still... I still hadn't seen the end of the march, and it was very good natured. There were some police about, not many, even the cars, that were stopped in the traffic, were peeping their horns and showing support for us. Some people waving from windows to support us. So there was a lot of support, a lovely atmosphere, and actually. You know, my husband would have liked to have gone, but we've got a new puppy, so somebody had to stay at home with him. And my neighbours would have liked to have gone, but they were their taxi drivers, and they had bookings for wedding for the day, so they couldn't go. So in a sense, I felt that I was going on my own, but representing quite a lot of other people. And then having got back and spoken to other people when I've got back, I think that if they, when they have the next one, it's quite likely that that may be even bigger. I hope it is, because. But what was so disappointing, Tony, I think that the independent media have reported it. But what was so disappointing was that there was absolutely nothing on BBC, absolutely nothing on Sky, nothing on the ITV news. All of the mainstream news just completely ignored it. Well, even if, you know, such a large event, which was... I suppose you have a lot of people getting together, not wearing masks, not necessarily social distancing, singing, chanting, doing all the things that we're told not to do. You would have thought that would have been worthy of the news if the government are wanting a pandemic to story to carry on.
Where do you see things heading with this, Judith?
Well, I just see a world in which people are going to be much more restricted, much more under surveillance. There's talk of depopulation, i.e. maybe it's talk, I don't know. I think that jobs are going to be very difficult. It's going to be designed so that social contact is much more difficult. People who, you know, I just keep thinking people who are... populations are going to be seriously controlled. And then I keep thinking that when they've reduced jobs by the use of IT, then there's going to be a lot of surplus people that are just going to need to be fed and housed. And I think that they're not going to be necessary to the new regime.
That's Dr. Judith Brown talking to me. I mean, she's been on this programme many times now, actually, mostly talking about Yemen, because she is an expert on Yemen, having worked as a nurse out there as part of the UN programme. You know, she's a bit concerned about all this, Martin, the way it's going towards more surveillance. You less so.
No, I think what's happened is it's, I mean, at the risk of repeating myself, it was a biological warfare attack on China, which was then used to cover up the collapse of the banking system and then to put in place surveillance capitalism in the world. But of course, it's not worked inside China.
What about all this increasing reliance on the universal credit, universal basic income, the idea that you're not necessarily going to expect to get a job, but you will get a little bit of money from the government every week to survive on, and that's becoming more and more, much more widespread now.
Well, I think it's an absolutely key thing. We need it. But, of course, even if it's brought in, they will then use it as a means of social control. And the only way to stop that is to have it as a right that you can get this universal credit and that you can't be punished for not by the powers that be.
But you know what's going to happen.
By the withdrawal.
I mean, as more and more people get on universal credit, that people will be targeted and the money will be withdrawn from people. Maybe, you know, for example, if they don't like the cut of their jib and they're politically, against the government or something. The idea that the whole country can just be reliant on the dole, surely that's just not realistic.
No, the way there's been lots of research done into this over the years. If I was in charge, which of course I'm not, I would make universal credit and everybody should get it, so that nobody can complain that somebody's getting something they're not. You basically, it should be based on whether you have participated in the political system. If you voted at the last election or even sport your ballot paper, you're entitled to claim universal credit and it can't be taken away from you.
So you have a kind of a universal credit box on the ballot paper. So I want my universal credit, but I don't want to vote for any of these people.
Yes, yeah, you don't have to vote for anybody, but you've got to participate. And of course, what would happen if you had a universal credit system is lots of tax breaks for people who are wealthier.
So if people don't vote,
would be withdrawn.
So if people don't vote, they don't eat.
That's
a bit extreme.
You
isn't it?
Could link it to that. I'm not saying you should. You could. But what will happen if it's an authoritarian system is universal credit will be, as is the case with the dole now.
People become on the dole, surely the more liable it is to be abused. I mean, the idea surely is to give people actually their own, stake in the economic system.
Yeah, but
Klaus Schwab and his friends don't seem to want to do that.
No.
They don't want you as part of, to be able to do your own thing. They want you to just be literally taking a grant of money like this universal basic income, but surely that is, if you're going down that road, what you're doing is you're saying that actually the government is going to control whether you eat or not.
Well, what's going to happen as the AI revolution occurs, as Judith was pointing out, is that millions of people are going to be with no source of income. And unless you have a political solution to that, those people will starve. And of course, it's not just in Britain. We're talking about the whole world here.
I mean, I'm not trying to say I don't like the idea of a universal basic income. I do. But then I think that actually what you need is people need to have access to resources rather than just going cap in hand to the government all the time. I mean, this is what's happened, hasn't it? I mean, you and I have been discussing this for years. The idea of full employment went out basically in the 1970s and down and down and down. But this suits a lot of the rich and powerful, the wealthy, the Tories, etc. What they like is they like to have this massive pool of labour that they can choose from, so that if some union activist annoys them, they can sack them and pick someone else up the next day.
If you, the concept of universal basic income is not that you live on the universal basic income. You get that, but you've got to do other things on top of it. I'm on universal credit at the moment, and I have been for several years now. But I go to work, but it becomes not in my interest to do too much work, because then I lose my benefit. A universal basic income would allow me to work more hours and earn more money,
well, it's not really
and therefore be better off.
I understand how it works. What I'm saying is, we seem to be moving towards a world where they don't actually want people to be doing their own businesses, employed, making stuff, selling stuff, or anything. They just want people to be almost like creatures of leisure, consumers, and nothing more. Is that a sort of inevitable slide from deindustrialisation over the last 50 years?
The fact of the matter is that the capitalism as an economic system is fantastically efficient. But it becomes so efficient that it actually gets rid of the workforce. And then, of course, if you've got no workforce, they've then got nobody to buy the stuff that's been produced. So then
they've got
then
a workforce. They've got a workforce in China.
Yes, I know they have. But even in China, some years ago, they robotized a factory. They've got they're leading the world in robotics, and they've actually been able to make factories which have virtually no employees.
So is it possible to have this technology which can actually serve mankind rather than disenfranchise everybody and leave us with a whole load of very vulnerable people who are just relying on government handouts that could be cut off at any time?
Well, it's a political struggle. I mean, it's all there in the Communist Manifesto written in the 1840s. Ultimately, the proletariat, the workers, the population have to overthrow capitalism, and then all this technology then becomes useful.
Well, you
to
get
us.
This whole thing of the workers control the means of production, don't you? But what about the people controlling their means of economic survival? There's none of that. There's not really talk about that.
In developing countries, you need a radical land reform so that everybody has got a piece of land. But that, of course, means getting rid of the existing landlord class, who are the officers in the army in Brazil, for example. They are the landlord class, and they're not going to allow people to grow their own food. They basically run people off the land so that they can grow soybeans to feed to pigs and cattle, basically undermine the development of the country. But of course, in Southeast Asia, in Japan, in China, in South Korea and in Taiwan, the landlord class was eliminated. In China, quite literally eliminated. Millions of people were basically done to death by the communist revolutionaries, and they gave the land to the ordinary people. They then made lots of silly decisions after that. But ultimately, the real problem is that the wealthy classes in all countries do not want to have a situation where they lose their power, and they're prepared to pull the whole world down to keep their system, their rotten system, going. And of course, ultimately, there'll have to be a showdown about that.
Well, the situation in India with COVID has been in the news all week this week, and obviously it's pretty serious. What exactly is going on there, though? Quite worrying, Martin, to see a guy, he is India's, health ambassador, and he's an actor, but he's just taken his COVID vaccine and died, even though he's the health ambassador for India. He's a Tamil chap, and I couldn't quite believe this. He's a popular Tamil actor and comedian. Vivek died this morning in the hospital hours after he was admitted after a cardiac arrest. He was 59 years old, and he's died just after having the vaccine. Now, that vaccine was supposed to protect him. Looks like it killed him.
Well, the jury's still out on this. I mean, it's quite possible that vaccines are dangerous. But of course, in China, they've got no lockdown, and the economy's moving ahead because they've got free healthcare. In India, even in normal times, half the population can't afford to see a doctor. So, of course, when a pandemic comes along, they die like flies.
So should we be taking advice about vaccines from adverts on the radio or the TV? Should we be taking, more importantly, advice from the Metropolitan Police about whether or not to take a vaccine? I find this quite surprising, Martin. This is in Spiked Online. Neil Basu should stick to the day job, says Paul Stott. The counter-terrorism chief wants new laws to censor anti-vaxxers. What on earth has this got to do with him? 2020 has been the worst year for civil liberties in Britain in many decades, blah, blah. And he goes on about Orwell. But then he says, Assistant Commissioner of Metropolitan Police Neil Basu has called for a introduction of new laws to punish those who spread anti-vaccination conspiracy theories. In this, he follows concerns raised by Labour Party's shadow health spokesman John Ashworth and Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer. However, in suggesting the need for legislation and criminalisation of anti-vaccination activists, Basu, a public official, appears to be running ahead of the politicians. So why is the Assistant Commissioner for the Metropolitan Police telling us that we need new laws to stop the spread of anti-vax conspiracy theories?
Well, you'd need to ask him whether he thinks that's an appropriate thing for him to weigh in on.
Well, he obviously does. I think it's interesting.
On my Microsoft feed on my computer, I actually get lots of articles from the Daily Express, which I normally wouldn't read, but there they are, so I have a little look at them. And they, of course, are very, very anti-vax. Anti-vaxxers.
I don't think maybe a Daily Express are anti-vax. No,
they're not anti-vax.
No.
Because the vaccine is causing a bump in support for the Conservative Party, some of the people who've been most anti-lockdown, like the Daily Express, are very keen.
Can you talk about the story which I've just introduced here, which is about the Assistant Chief Constable, or Assistant of the Metropolitan Police, telling everybody that we need a new law to stop people criticising vaccines?
I would suggest that that's beyond his job description, but what I'm saying is interesting. There's a split developing on the right of British politics, on the COVID recovery group and so on, very anti-lockdown, but they in fact are very pro-vaccine because it's helping. They don't want people not to take the AstraZeneca vaccine because it's helping the Tories in the opinion
polls. The thing is, how does he as he points out in this article, Paul Stott points out, a second issue is how he found the time for this intervention, not least when the authorities have repeatedly stressed the scale of the terrorist threat facing Britain. He's the lead anti-terror lead. In fact, he's the person who would have signed off that raid on the Bath PTSD site, which we reported on a few weeks ago, Martin, where he was saying that they believe that there were concealed firearms down there, unlicensed firearms, because the guy that ran it had applied for a firearms license. There were no concealed firearms. There was nothing to find down there. They didn't even plant something, which is amazing in this situation. But they haven't found any terrorists. What they're doing is they're going around finding people who are criticising vaccines and arresting them instead.
Well, as I say, because the Tories are doing so well in the opinion polls as a result of the vaccination programme, they are very hostile to people criticising vaccines.
And almost all of the terrorist attacks we've had, in fact, I think every single one of them in this country, it's been his job to be arresting those people, but they haven't been. They've been well known to MI5 and the anti-terrorist police, and yet they've gone ahead and done terrorist attacks anyway.
Well, as we all know, what happened in Manchester, the bombing in Manchester, was carried out by the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who've been in cahoots with MI6 since the 1980s.
The guy who supposedly did it was phoned into the anti-terror hotline. So, you know, he isn't doing his job on anti-terror, but he is deciding that he's going to go and raid a bunch of people who are ex-servicemen who are recovering from PTSD, who he thinks might be... it's basically a fishing operation that he's doing there. Now, I find this, particularly galling that we've had this thing on police corruption that we were listening to earlier on, the Bent Coppers thing, and there he is weighing in on we've got to stop the anti-vaxxers. Now, I think he should go. You know, there's no way that this guy should be in that job, and we can't trust him to look after our interests, certainly not to protect us from terrorists. He's done an absolutely appalling job so far. Anyway, so, okay, that one out of the way. Let's move on and have a listen again to the second clip we've got with Judith Brown. And I spoke to her because she's in touch with people in India and elsewhere, and particularly with other doctor friends, because she's a former nurse herself, about what's really going on in India.
First of all, I think that the government has a great interest, and governments throughout the world have a great interest in keeping the fear of COVID persistent. And if you can find a country where they have a large peak in cases, then India is a good example. And also, I think undoubtedly the healthcare system in India isn't coping. But that's hardly surprising, because under Modi they've privatised the healthcare system and seriously underfunded it. And I think this healthcare system not coping has been an ongoing thing for a long time. The oxygen shortage is another issue, but apparently India knew that it was short of oxygen. It was reported not this March, but the March before. So you're talking about 13 months ago, and it didn't build up its stocks. But I think one thing that is quite interesting, and again, I'm not saying that it's causative, but it's an interesting notion. And this isn't to say that I'm not sympathetic with all of the people that have become ill or that have passed away in India, because obviously that's a tragedy for the people concerned. But interestingly, India, which has actually had a very low percentage of deaths per million, it's around 143, I think, at the moment, compared to us, which in UK, for example, where we're pushing on towards 2,000 deaths per million recorded as being related to coronaviruses. But so obviously, you've got much bigger numbers in India, and if you can say 3,000 extra people have died, and it sounds a lot, but it's not it's not so big when you consider that the population is 20 times larger than UK. So there's various reasons why one thinks that the figures may have been manipulated. But if you go back to the summer, I did read an article which I've tried to look out for this evening, and I can't find it anywhere where I've saved it. But there was an article to say that Modi had some differences over the vaccine implementation and distribution in India. I don't know what that difference was, but that decided to recommend ivermectin. Ivermectin, as you know, is a drug that is very safe, very effective against COVID, both prophylactically and for treatment, looking at lots of random controlled studies. I think that one can say definitely it is. But Modi apparently started using ivermectin, and that was last August. And from then on, the number of cases in India sort of dropped quite dramatically, really. By September, you could see the sort of like the significant drop in cases, and that continued to be really low. They have a unit in India that manufactures AstraZeneca vaccines, and they also have an Indian vaccine. I'm not sure how many the Indian vaccine is using, but I think the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is manufactured under license in India, is the largest number of vaccines that are actually being given at the moment. And the vaccine rollout actually started on the 15th of January this year. And at that point, ivermectin was dropped and the vaccine rollout started. First of all, for the first 2 months, all of the doses that were given to healthcare workers. They weren't given to vulnerable people, but the policy was to immunize all of the healthcare workers first. So through January, February, the people who were immunized tended to be younger people. And then the big rollout started last month. And of course, in similar to vaccine rollouts in every country, including in UK, the vaccine rollouts, for whatever reason, appears to be associated with a rise in both cases and deaths. And in this case, it was notable that it started when the vaccine started rolling out to vulnerable people, rather than when it was rolled out in January to the healthcare workers. So there does seem to be an association there in India, just as much as there are as one's seen that same association in the rest of the world. For example, in UK, because we gave our vulnerable people the vaccine first, then the peak went up, and then when we started immunizing people who were younger, then the peak sort of then the number of cases and deaths declined after that. But the peak in India has come a bit later because of a difference in policy. So what I don't want to say is that ivermectin that ivermectin was definitely stopping the cases beforehand, and the vaccine definitely has started cases and deaths, because I really don't know that. But what I'm saying is there is an association, and I think this is worthy of further investigation.
So that's Dr. Judith Brown, a bit of a regular on this show, talking about this, that and everything else, particularly about the pandemic and also about the conditions in Yemen. And I put a long version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where she gets stuck into what's going on in Yemen too, but we don't have time for that. Martin, this is it's becoming pretty obvious that this ivermectin stuff is, I mean, they were using it in India up until the end of last year. They started using the vaccine in January, and now they've had an enormous leap in the number of deaths in India, and literally today the Indian government have announced a resumption of the use of ivermectin as a treatment. Now, you'd have thought, I mean, they've been using it all this time, they've done quite well. I'm guessing that it's the vaccine lobby that said, oh, you can use our vaccines, you can have our vaccines, but you're going to have to stop ivermectin, back in January. So this could just simply be Big Pharma using the levers of power in order to stop what is actually a cheap, free and easy treatment in India.
Well, I'm obviously, not being medically trained, I'm not sure one way or the other. But the economic background of the pharmaceutical industry in the West essentially trying to monopolise all treatments for anything, really, is overwhelming. I mean, India and South Africa at the beginning of the crisis called for patents on drugs, vaccines to be used to deal with COVID, to be, not to be treated as intellectual property. And that was squashed immediately by wealthy countries like Britain and the United States, in which the pharmaceutical industry is based. So
these pharmaceutical industry, let's be clear, from what David Miller was saying also about the general lobbying that goes on, these politicians selling their soul literally the day after an election to whoever is the highest bidder. It's absolutely, it's killed millions of people potentially here.
Yes, I mean, and if the vaccines turn out to be dangerous, because of course they've been rushed through without the usual tests.
Well, the great thing about the vaccines is you have to keep taking them every year.
Well,
in fact, have you had your second one yet? Can I ask?
Not yet, no.
Are you going to, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's in for a penny, in for a pound, Tony, isn't it?
Are you going to have three?
Well, I mean, this is what may happen. Is what seems to be happening in Brazil and in India is that lots of younger people are contracting COVID and dying. Now, I'm not sure what's happening. I'm just watching like everybody else. But the potential is that new strains will develop, which then make the vaccination program that we've had in Britain irrelevant.
A waste of time. Maybe.
But actually, a load of money has been spent on it.
What it does again, of course, is should focus us again on things like ivermectin, which don't care what strain it is. It just stops the virus to actually get into your cell, to colonise your cell, hijack your cell's replication mechanism and churn out millions of little versions of itself.
Yes, and of course, as you know, the Southeast Asian countries, which did the right public health measures at the beginning, are pulling ahead away from the rest of the world now, because they haven't got any COVID, and they've got no lockdowns either. And of course, this is not going to go away quickly. Countries are still going to be struggling with this, probably for years to come, apart from those who did the right things at the beginning, and they're in the clear.
Well, those that have herd immunity.
Well, herd immunity is only really feasible through vaccination.
No, not necessarily, no.
Well, I totally disagree with you, Tony.
No, well, you know, of course that's just not the case. It's not the case at all.
They're not going for herd immunity in China.
In the 1970s, there was herd immunity there was very nearly herd immunity to measles before the vaccines started to be introduced. And so what you can do is you can sculpt your dealing of a virus by making sure that people contract that virus at an age where it's not harmful for them, and then the rest of their life they're protected by their natural immune system. Surely it's much better to use things like ivermectin and vitamin D and vitamin C to boost your own immune system, rather than to work people into an annual program. It's just becoming much like the flu vaccine, isn't it? So you're going to have a COVID vaccine every year, as well as all your flu jabs, and then inject your newborn child with five vaccines the moment they're born.
There's lots of different...
This is about money, it's not about health,
yes, of course.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, well, fundamentally, that's the problem with capitalism as a whole. It's basically based on private appropriation of profit and the public good be damned. And there's a problem that people are basically taking one line or another in relation to this, and they're taking a package on board. The vaccines could be dangerous. I'm totally willing to accept that. That's a completely separate issue from whether ivermectin works or not, completely separate issue about whether you should wear masks, and a completely separate issue about whether lockdowns do or don't work. They work if they're carried out properly, as has been the case in New Zealand and China. They don't work if you mess around like we did in this country.
Well, we haven't heard about it much here, but it's Ramadan, and there's Friday prayers over in Palestine today, and a headliner on Press TV, which both Martin and I have been on this week, the headline is Palestinian demonstrators urge Hamas to hit Israel. Well, that might sound like it's not a very religious, faithful thing to say for these demonstrators, but obviously they're not all mullahs or whatever. But the Palestinians staged mass demonstration after Friday prayers today in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in support of Hamas, urging the resistance group to hit Israel amidst intensified attacks on Palestinians in the Holy City. They chanted slogans in support of the Palestine resistance movement, Hamas, and its military wing, Edzin al-Qassam Brigades, on the third Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, urging the resistance forces to strike Israel. Now, this is, since we know that Israel would rather like to strike back and is looking for an excuse, this is a little bit worrying.
Well, there was actually a riot by right-wing Jewish groups calling death to Arabs this week as well. And they're basically turning up the pressure around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, attacking people going to worship during Ramadan and so on. And the potential for a major war in the Middle East is definitely there. And, of course, there's an election coming up to the Palestine authorities in which Hamas are in competition with Fatah. So, you know, that they're electioneering at the same time. And, of course...
Well, at least President Netanyahu in Israel was booed by protesters at the site of this stampede today. So the other day. He turned up at the stampede site where a lot of religious worshippers were killed in a stampede a couple of days ago, and they booed him. So obviously he's not really wanted around there. He's not really thought of as a leader. He's just a gangster, really, as I suppose many political leaders are, trying to hang on to power.
Yes, well, it seems that he has managed to hang on to power, and of course they are calling for a war with Iran. And Boris Johnson will be asked, do you want a war with Iran? And that's what people need to realise, that the British government is quite likely to say yes.
But Mahmoud Abbas has decided to delay the long-awaited legislative elections, sparking demonstrations in West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It was supposed to be the first Palestinian elections in 15 years, but he's just said, no, we're not having those.
Well, that's because Hamas would probably win, as they did in 2006. And, of course, Hamas cannot be allowed to win.
This is like a horrendous rump parliament from our civil war, isn't it? It's just going on and on and on.
Yeah, well,
no refreshment from new developments.
The stuff I've been reading suggests that Marwan Barghouti, who's actually a Fatah activist, who's actually in prison. You see, lots and lots of Palestinians, elected Palestinian MPs, are in prison in Israel. They're not allowed to act as MPs. They're basically held in solitary confinement by the Israeli state. So the situation is becoming intolerable.
Had a raid, didn't we, recently on the Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Israelis. Happen periodically. Right. Can you just explain what happened there?
Well, the far right in Israel want to basically get rid of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and rebuild the temple.
This is the third temple,
yeah,
folks.
Supposedly, yeah.
The Phoenicians built Solomon.
The other thing that's going on is
originally
this missile attack which nearly hit Dimona, which is the Israeli nuclear reactor, was a shot over the bows of the Israelis by the Syrians. Because they're getting fed up with what's going on.
They're also getting a bit confident that they've actually won this so-called civil war, which was actually orchestrated by the West.
Yeah.
And
another thing that's happened,
saying that you just don't mess with us, you know?
Yeah, well, they've also said they're going to take the Golan Heights back, which, of course, in international law, they're totally within their rights to do. And there's a lot of oil up there, which would be very useful to them. But one of the other things that's been happening is the Israelis have been attacking oil tankers from Iran, which have been coming through the Suez Canal and coming to Syria to provide oil, because the Syrian oil fields have been occupied by the Americans. but the Russian Navy have been carrying out convoy duties to protect the Iranian oil shipments. And the Israeli state has been put on warning that if you carry on attacking these tankers, the Russian Navy is going to shoot your planes down or sink your ships. And that's a very clear signal. The Russians don't do things. They don't shout from the rooftops. But when they do things, they're making a clear signal to the Israelis, back off, just as they did with the Ukrainians over the Donbass.
Okay, in the background to this potential flashpoint, and I mean, it's just appalling the way that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is constantly targeted. You know, let's leave these guys alone, please. Just let them get on with it, you know. Is the China thing, we go back to that again briefly, who is creating a new Chinese bogeyman, which is an examination of modern psychological warfare on the FortRus.com site. He's saying on this is Matthew Eret, anti-nation state fanatic. George Soros stated at the 2020 Davos summit, China has become the greatest threat to his vision for the open society, right behind Trump's USA. And this has also been echoed by Lord Malach Brown's global governance speeches. So it seems that the great resetters and their pals are actually, although they're saying, oh, we need to have peace with China, on the other hand, they're speaking out with forked tongues, aren't they? On the other side, they're saying, oh, gosh, we've got to, you know, China is the greatest threat to world peace, or actually, in this case, it's just Soros talking about his open society.
Yes, and of course that shows that the Great Reset is essentially a project of the Western elites. They see Russia and China as an obstacle to their world domination, and therefore it's not, you know, the right wing in the US who are opposed to the Great Reset see it as a Chinese communist plot, which is absurd when you think people like Soros and others are absolutely hostile to the Chinese regime.
In 2020, Lord Malach Brown was revealed, this is on the Strategic Culture Foundation website, Lord Malach Brown was revealed as the British hand behind the coup, showing his scales again. This is another article by Matthew Eret. Russiagate, he believes the hand of British intelligence has revealed itself continuously, from the obvious role of Sir Richard Dearlove and his former MI6 underling Christopher Steele, who together played a driving role in shaping the dodgy dossier, to their involvement with Oxford Rhodes scholar Strobe Talbot in composing, promoting and marketing a fraudulent dossier targeted to members of Congress and media, to the British ambassador Sir Darroch, caught flooding the zone with British intelligence assets to shape Trump's perception of the world, to the array of British entrapment operations that targeted Michael Flynn in 2014 in London. Wherever where one looks, the hand of British intelligence seems to be everywhere. In this case, Martin, it's the whole Russiagate scandal. This guy's been behind it. Someone called Lord Malach Brown.
Yeah, he's been around for quite a while. Well, yes, I mean, the intelligence services, I was just saying on RT earlier this afternoon, in the West, are very, very active. They intervene at every level of the political process, and the elected politicians are very much being pushed around by them.
And
at the same time, we claim to be a democracy, and that the Russians are supposedly some evil dictatorship, even though they've got an election coming up in September in Russia, which will be relatively free and fair, as these things are, and there will be a full spectrum of political parties
and
participating.
Alexei Navalny will get about...
Because it's a PR system.
Alexei Navalny will get about
system.
Three votes, maybe. The background to all of this, of course, is we're just not being told what's really going on now. Importantly, as George Orwell is always pointing out, we're not being told about history either. We're not being told about the background. So I've struck a little blow for that today with my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which is about the origins of the Bilderberg conferences, and also the battle in the Second World War, which is featured in the film A Bridge Too Far, the links between the two. That is should be just coming out in the next couple of weeks in paperback as well. But you can still get it for a tenner if you want to actually buy it, or you can get it free with a watermark copy off of the website bilderberg.org. So we're really trying to pull apart some of the end game of the Second World War, which is so important to understanding what's going on today with this kind of Fourth Reich, which is Klaus Schwab and his chums. But anyway, the reason that, you know, we're not on FM, we're only on the internet, is because of the complete and utter failure of the treacherous mass media to tell us what's really going on. And that isn't the fault of the journalists, it's the fault of the owners, it's the fault of the managers, the people that you never see on your TV screens, the producers behind the scenes that just tell you nonsense. There are loads and loads of talk about the Prime Minister's flat refurbishment, when actually there's millions of people who have got desperately awful conditions in mould and stuff in their flats across the country, or got no home at all. And I just thought we'd come to a conclusion, Martin, by looking at this whole thing, Operation Mockingbird. The CIA used to infiltrate the media. Now the CIA is the media. This is Caitlin Johnson, an excellent article on Signs of the Times, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The CIA's Operation Mockingbird has succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of any Soviet propaganda.
Yes, well, Mockingbird, as we all know, people can look it up on the computers. The CIA has always been heavily influencing the media in the West. We've now reached a situation where they actually are the media in the West.
Well, the former CIA director William Colby says the CIA owns everyone of any significance in the major media.
Yes, and as I said earlier, the Western intelligence services, enthralled to the deep state, are extremely active. And that's why, for example, we've got all these bills which will basically make intelligence operatives above the law, because they're already above the law. And we go on about, you know, China's a police state, Russia's a police state. We're a police state, and it's a more effective police state because people have got the delusion that they've got some kind of agency, when in actual fact they haven't.
Yeah, so the media, we will carry on. One of the things I've been doing in the last 4 weeks, Anton Chaitkin is this week's conspiracy classics person. Number four he is in the list. You're welcome to stay and have a listen to this, Martin. It's about B'nai B'rith, mainly. And he's done what I think is an excellent long speech. This is from 1994. But he is the guy, I was saying at the beginning of the show, his father was Jacob Chaitkin, who was the chief lawyer and strategist for the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany in the United States. This, of course, is the boycott, isn't it, which was broken by the Zionists. We often forget this, and this is the reason. This whole business is the reason why Ken Livingstone was expelled from the Labour Party, for simply stating that fact.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it's just historical fact. Can't be changed. Happened a long time ago. But nevertheless, anybody who mentioned this is accused of anti-Semitism. Not very fair, is it?
No, it's not at all fair. Well, it's just about the rule by the mob, really. The strong survive, the rule by the rich. Survivor of the fittest, law of the jungle, whatever you want to call it. That's the message that we're getting in our politics today. Be interesting to see how we get on next week. We'll have all the results here. But we're going to finish this week with a clip from Anton Chaitkin. He's, as I said, he's the son of the Jacob Chaitkin, who was the chief strategist and lawyer for the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, which was broken by the Zionists, much to the rest of these Jews' annoyance. See, here he is talking about, particularly about B'nai B'rith, but also the general discussion is around the influence of the British Empire and what he sees as a financial empire that's been spreading over the world for centuries.
B'nai B'rith, which is, the words are, mean sons of the covenant. It's Hebrew words. B'nai B'rith was set up, allegedly, in 1843... in New York City by approximately 12 obscure Freemasons. The B'nai B'rith was quickly centered actually in Cincinnati in the 1850s. And its virtual sole preoccupation was a very small organization. By the time of the Civil War, it had about between 1,000 and 1,500 members in America. Its preoccupation was to build up the party that was trying to break up the United States. They ran various southern and northern, which were called Copperhead, political operations. And we've written a lot about this. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail on that. But these people, even though most of the Jewish people in America were living in the north, especially after immigrants came in from Germany, And most of the Jewish people in the Civil War were pro-Union. The B'nai B'rith was entirely pro-Confederate. And many of its leaders were arrested by the United States as Confederate spies during the American Civil War, including the head of the B'nai B'rith operation in Washington, D.C., Simon Wolfe. He was arrested almost immediately upon coming to Washington by Lincoln, by the head of Lincoln's Secret Service. Later on, he was a close friend of John Wilkes Booth, and the day that Lincoln was assassinated, he went drinking with John Wilkes Booth, and they supposedly talked about John Wilkes Booth's personal problems, and a few hours later, Wilkes Booth killed Lincoln. This is a part of the British party in Freemasonry, the British faction in politics, and they're allied to other British operatives. So you can't understand this without, again, going back to this question of Great Britain. Remember that we had a revolution against England. And then a generation later, that was in 1776. In 1812, we had another war against England, the Second War of Independence. They wanted to take the country back. We beat them in that war. Then there was a civil war later on, 1861. And the British supplied guns to the South. They wanted to break up the United States. They didn't want to have any free countries anywhere. They didn't want to have any strong nations anywhere. So they whipped up the Southerners to fight against the United States. They lost that. They didn't give up. They still had, in fact, they had more and more power as an empire. And they have these factions. Now, I was talking earlier about their faction among the Jews. The Jewish religion is a survival from ancient times. There's various complications to it, but it's essentially identified with the Old Testament. Well, these people are not religious. The B'nai B'rith is a social organization, a political organization, and the basis of the B'nai B'rith is a political manipulation of race. They have a committee called the Anti-Defamation League. That's a committee of this B'nai B'rith. In the 20th century, when this Anti-Defamation League has existed, they have specialized in saying in public that certain people were anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And they're very selective about this because they didn't participate during the time that Hitler was the dictator of Germany. They didn't participate in the movement against Hitler. They also participated in the Ku Klux Klan. They also blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover, who had certain sexual problems and certain personal problems. Gay Edgar Hoover. And you'll find that the gangsters who make up, I'll give you an example of one of these guys, Mo Dalitz. Morris Dalitz, D-A-L-I-T-Z, got the award from the B'nai B'rith, from the Anti-Defamation League. They call it the Torch of Liberty Award because he gave him a lot of money. But also because he's an owner of Hollywood Productions. He is he's the main corporate owner for Meyer Lansky in Las Vegas. He is one of the five or six chiefs of organized crime in America. There are other people like Kenneth Bialk and others. Organized crime of the Meyer Lansky faction, that is Jewish organized crime, is represented in the political world by this Anti-Defamation League. Now, what is their religion? See, this is where you get down to the brass tacks of the thing. In New York City, they had a chancellor of schools recently driven out of office by the voters and the parents because he was promoting something called the Rainbow Curriculum. Sounds vaguely like Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, right? Good liberal mishmash, right? Well, this Rainbow Curriculum promoted the idea that the children should be taught to be comfortable with homosexuals, with adult homosexuals. And the parents thought this was not a good idea. A lot of the people promoting that were members of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, who were pederasts. B. The Anti-Defamation League fought for that curriculum, helped to produce that curriculum, and fought against the people who didn't like it, including Jews, Christians, and others in New York City. Now, what's the religious basis for them doing that? Well, you have to understand what they represent. In the real world, they represent what I've been talking about tonight. These are thugs representing this traditional party of criminal activities associated with the British Empire.
Yes, the British Empire. And he's for a long time, he was one of the chief researchers at the LaRouche Foundation. And they seem to think that the British are responsible for everything. And I do wonder sometimes when we created the United States of America, the New World Order, right from our merchant ventures here in Bristol, financing Cabot's trip, the genocide of millions of Native Americans and the setting up of a New World Order in the New World by Freemasons. And almost, I think, all of the presidents have been Freemasons so far. And then setting up the State of Israel too, even though apparently we did it reluctantly. Obviously, the Balfour Declaration made that happen. So, you know, there's a fascinating side to all of this, I think. But we're really worrying there to see that these Zionists, the ADL and the B'nai B'rith, seem to be completely and nothing to do with Judaism, the actual faith itself. But they're just using the faith in order to get money and get influence. That's what it seems to me anyway. And Anton, you know, as a Jew himself, is making it absolutely clear what the people who are the inheritors of the rabbinic tradition that was an attempt of the Nazis to exterminate that in Europe, that he'd picked up a fantastic amount of knowledge and deep insight by those Jews into the way the world really works. And there he is imparting it and saying that the British are already responsible for a lot of the ills of the world, if not all of them, pretty much. So, you know, we need to be able to be a little bit self-critical, don't we? And so that's where we're finishing this evening. That's number four, and I'll put the full version of that talk, which I think is about 2 hours long, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and we've got a compilation page of all of the conspiracy classics. That's number four, and that winds things up for this week. There'll be a little bit of news, I hope, about the paperback publication of The Traitors of Arnhem, my book about the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, next week. But anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Saf Hussein from the Bristol Blue Cabs in the first hour, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, do whack me an email or ping me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, and you'll find that email address on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk, along with the extended interviews with Judith Brown and also with others that you've heard tonight. Now, if you've a site or a story you'd like to share, you think there's anything I've missed or have a correction, please do email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have if possible. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's weekly podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, but I'm back miraculously on Facebook, having tried their appeal process, and I was on a 3-day then a 10-day ban, and now I'm back. Just as my 10-day ban was about, no, sorry, 7-day ban was about to expire, they let me come back again. So I will be weighing in a bit with the elections on Facebook, no doubt. So I can't say thank you to Facebook, really, because it was actually rather irritating to be giving potentially life-saving information than to be told that you're killing people. But then I suppose that's you know, the topsy-turvy world of social media and almost all the media we've got nowadays. So I'm asking people to write to Ofcom about the political removal of our show by the Blairite Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's longtime chum, BCFM station manager Patrick Hart. You'll find those addresses of their BCFM head honchos, etc., on the contact tab at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRS stream here, and over Sunday lunchtime at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make recordings of the stream if you can. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today. due to the collusion of these jellyfish media managers. So if you too can restream this live, this stream that is, or rebroadcast over the weekend, do just credit this show to thisweek.org.uk. Let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.